Good morning, folks. Sorry, I was a little late for coffee, was not ready, but it is ready now. So there is coffee out there. We are going to perhaps be meeting tonight. I will not adjourn after this meeting. I will recess, and here's the reason why. We are going to finish up DNR tonight, and it's taken us a while to get through their results from the last year's budget, and probably appropriately so. This is new for DNR, and it is new for us to be budgeting for results. So what we are learning now from DNR is what we'll use to compare the new budget with when it gets here, and to see what kind of results will be lost with the cuts. So, and if those are the results we feel that are the appropriate ones to be lost, or if there should be other ones that we won't do. So, with that, Mr. Meyer, if you would go through the remainder of the units of DNR that have to be done, so that folks have a notion of how much we can get done this morning and how much we might have to get done tonight.
Madam Chair, members, for the record, Bob Meyer, Assistant Commissioner, Department of Natural Resources. The remainder of the outcomes that we have to discuss include the Trails and Waterways Division, which now is part of the Parks and Trails Division, but since for 0809 we're talking about parks separately, which we finished up last time. We're talking about trails today. Next, we're going to move into Fish and Wildlife, then talk about enforcement, and then ecological resources, and then operation support. Madam Chair, my goal this morning would be to complete Trails and Waterways, Fish and Wildlife, and begin enforcement. I don't know if we can finish that or not. And then we're going to need to have a little bit more. I think the two issues that the committee will want to spend a little bit of time on, one is going to be Fish and Wildlife, because they do have a large budget, a lot of things to talk about, and also ecological resources. That might take some time. It's rather kind of unpeeling the onion on the funding sources, because ecological resources has so many different funds that are kind of commingled on activities, so we need to have a good understanding of that. Operation support shouldn't take long. If we came back and started at 6:30, it's my goal to be out of here. It would be my goal to be done by 8 o'clock, if not sooner, Madam Chair.
Lots of work, folks. So judge your questions accordingly.
Would you like us to proceed?
Yes, please.
Madam Chair, members, you should have in front of you, it'll be three different PowerPoints or pieces for each division we discussed this morning. The first one will be Trails and Waterways. We left off with this slide here talking about the strategic objectives, and with me I have Cortland Nelson, who is actually the deputy of Cortland. How would you like to put it? Forrest Bowe, who is actually the deputy of the Parks and Trails Division. I apologize. And he was the director of the Trails and Waterways Division, so he will be talking about the outcomes associated with that. Just quickly, the strategic objectives for this division is to create recreation opportunities and a high-quality system of trails and water recreation facilities through operations and maintenance, plan acquisition, development, and community assistance. The community assistance activities focus on grant and aid activities, working with those local clubs, local units of government to kind of where the rubber meets the road, Madam Chair. We work directly with them on acquisitions, on trail development, trail maintenance and repair. You can see just in the sidebar, we have over 1,200 miles of multi-use state trails, including 575 miles of paved bicycle trails. We rank third in the nation for total boats registered, with 30 designated canoe and boating routes encompassing over 4,000 miles. And we have 363 grants that we work with 363 local communities and local organizations providing funding to maintain these activities. Just quickly on the trail piece, Madam Chair, the state legislature authorized, we have legislatively authorized trails over 2,500 miles of trails that are in statute right now, but we only have acquired 1,200 miles of those up and running. It takes a long time to work with each individual landowner and community in aligning these trails, acquiring those individual segments, and then getting them up and running. So there's a little bit of a disconnect, but we're working as fast as we can to make sure that that trail system does become developed.
Would you repeat those numbers for members and tell us if you have the funding for all of that or if you only have the funding for part of it?
Madam Chair, Forrest Bell, Deputy Director of the Parks and Trails Division, and thanks for the opportunity to be here this morning. I think I can provide, again, a few of those numbers. The legislature has authorized 26 different state trails, totaling about 2,500 miles of state trail. Currently, there's 21 of those trails that actually have some acquisition or development occurring on those. We have about 1,266 miles developed. Of that 1,266, 575 miles are now have some kind of a paved surface, mainly asphalt surface. There's a couple of trails that have that are paved with a limestone surface. And Madam Chair, the other question.
Do you have the money to do all this?
Do we have the money to do this? In the last biennial budget, the legislature funded an additional $750,000 provided to the base in our general fund operations for the maintenance and operation of these state trails. Clearly, at this level, we're able to do a variety of things. We're able to do some minimal sweeping, some minimal brushing, some crack sealing, but probably not operate to the level that some people might expect us to operate those state trails.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We're in the process of preparing a one-page fact sheet on all the trails that are out there and the funding sources and things of that nature for the committee, and we look forward to presenting more detailed information as we talk about 2010-11 budget as well.
Now, as we talk about that budget, it would be helpful, just as we had for parks in the bonding bill, we had a list of all those things that needed to be done over a 10-year time frame. It was the deferred maintenance on one hand, and then it was the new things that people anticipated that we would need to have done, and we had a dollar amount for that. So it gave this committee a perspective on what needed to be done over 10 years, and I think that was critical for us in how we got to bonding and actually got bonding dollars.
Madam Chair, would you like that to focus on acquisition and repair? Rehab.
We'll need to know the whole ball of wax.
Okay.
We're going to, and we may not, I mean, this isn't a bonding year, but it gives us a perspective of what needs to be done. Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Meyer, kind of following up on that, is the Constitutional Amendment dollars, and one of the funds is our Parks and Trails funds. And just, and maybe you've gone over this, but how is the department going to work with development on proposals for the Parks and Trails Fund?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, that is a great question. As you're probably more keenly aware than a lot of people are, the three different funds, or the four different funds that are actually there, the Outdoor Heritage Fund, the LaSalle Outdoor Heritage Council is making recommendations on those dollars. The Parks and Trails Fund and the Clean Water Fund, there are recommendations contained within the governor's budget document on the allocation of those dollars, or at least portions of those dollars. Specifically on the Parks and Trails piece, we've been working with the Met Council, the regional parks, all the stakeholders, the greater Minnesota parks, and the recommendation in the governor's budget is to take those dollars and allocate them 38% for the statewide significant portion of that, 38% for the what I consider the metro portion, or its regional significance, the way the way the constitutional language is written, and then 24% would be used and distributed similar to our local initiative grants program that we operate for. The way the language reads, it would be for trails, regional trails in the metropolitan area and in greater Minnesota, through a grants program, just exactly like we have through the local initiatives program. Last year we had, and I'll get the numbers for you, Madam Chair, like $1 million or $2 million worth of funding for $32 million of requests for that program. So there is significant need out there. So we will be working through the legislature on that proposal that we have. And, you know, the clean water stuff we can talk about when we get back to 10 and 11 a little bit.
Representative Hanson, did you have a follow-up?
Follow-up. Thank you, Madam Chair. So on the distribution, you're looking at existing a block amount to an existing grant program, and then the agency would distribute out on an RFP request, or I'm talking about that 20% small portion.
Madam Chair, members, that's the intention right now. And I don't want to say exactly like the local initiatives program, but there are parameters that are there. In those discussions that we have, we may want to change that, or you may want to change that, I should say. And I can get more information on where we're at with that, specifically before we get to that point, and also we can talk about more in detail what our proposal would be at that time.
That's going to be helpful when we get into the next budget, but it's good to ask these questions now so you all are prepared. When I was reading the budget, I saw no outcomes for any of that money, which was troubling to me. Representative McNamara.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, Director Bolt, I'm real concerned about the deferred maintenance, and you mentioned $750,000. I think if the Chair has asked for this information, please give us the information how much we're underfunding and how we'd be better to be fixing the cracks now than doing a complete overlay. And I hope that we'll be looking at that possibility of spending some of that money as soon as possible and looking at fixing these trails up if there's sources for money that we, because we are way, way underfunding our maintenance. And I know you folks have been advocates to us. It's much easier and much better politically just to build new trails and dying to forget about the existing ones. But I hope now that we have this potential source of money and recognize the fact that we have not been doing this, Madam Chair. We have to get these fixed. And the other thing is it would be good for the economy right away to get it going.
Well, Representative McNamara, they did a good job when they laid out the park portion of the deferred maintenance and the new money that needed to be spent over 10 years. And they did have a 10-year plan, and that kind of thing, I think, would be very helpful for this community. Is there a question for me?
Actually, I think I have a question to you, Madam Chair. Maybe Mr. Meyer would like to comment on it. If the legislature authorized trails, and we haven't funded them, and we don't fund them for maintenance adequately, and we don't fund them for development adequately, how can we use the money from parks and trails to do that when that would be supplanting the money that the legislature's intent was to do in the first place? So what I'm asking is how is that all going to fit together, and would the parks and trails money only be for new projects and the maintenance of new projects, or is it for, you know, the legislature's already spoken on how many trails, 25, 23, 22, whatever they said. And now we don't give them the money. We don't have the money, but it says you can't supplant. So my idea is that the intention of the legislature was to fund those, and so it doesn't qualify for parks and trails money.
Representative Bill, I think we're going to have to choose to have a discussion here about supplanting. When I looked at the governor's budget, he took $91 million out of the general fund for the three accounts that this committee has, and then put almost all of the new money in the backfill. So we have some real questions before us. I think you bring it up. I think that's a long discussion, and we will be having it. I know Representative Murphy's committee is going to have that discussion. We may want to have that discussion with that committee. So let's just talk about it, and maybe we will go on down that road now. But you brought up the elephant in the room. All right.
I'm losing weight.
It wasn't you. So, all right, if you all will continue, you'll
Chair,
see some of the concerns that are that have been brought up by this budget proposal.
This is great, and I think it's important for members to realize too that that percentage of the dedicated dollars in no way, shape, or form will meet the needs of the park system, either statewide, regionally, or greater Minnesota, because, you know, the other sources of funding that are going to be needed for capital investment from bonding bills, general fund investment for operations, and other things like that are still needed. This is really more of a shot in the arm and some stability to those budgets rather than the be-all, end-all fix, especially for parks and trails. So it's important for people to realize that as well. Moving on to the Trails and Waterways 08-09 budget by strategic objective that we just discussed, 39%, actually it's on the other side, 44% for operations and maintenance, 17% is from planning, for planning, acquisition, and development, and 39% is for community assistance. And Madam Chair, I don't have this number on here, but it's something we'll provide with you. Out of this $72 million, only almost $4.8 million was general fund, with $750,000 of that being one time. So you're looking at $72.5 million paid for by people who are using the system, and a small portion of that $750,000 was general fund for non-motorized. So a lot of these revenues are from the water rec accounts, the snowmobile accounts, the ATV, the OHM, the recreational vehicle accounts, and we can get into that more specifically as we move forward, but it's just something for people to remember. Talking about strategic objective number one on the operations and maintenance side of things, the goal here is to provide and maintain a comprehensive system of non-motorized and motorized trails and water recreation facilities. If you go to the spreadsheet that we're working off of here, you should have a new one that says draft V2. It begins with page 7 now. It says Trails and Waterways. You can see where the funds here are $31,578,000, and we've broken it out by non-motorized recreation, state trails, equestrian trails, motorized recreation, snowmobile off-highway vehicles, and then water recreation. And you can see some of the accomplishments and innovations that we've had there, and we'll get into those more specifically. But this part of the Trails and Waterways program really focuses on state trails, state forest trails, public water access, water trails, scenic easements, fishing piers, and safe harbors. And it's making sure that those programs, basically those places where you want to go, are safe, are maintained in the best fashion, and are there. So there's a part of it supporting this. This is boots on the ground type activities. It's brushing trails, it's cleaning trails, it's sweeping, it's maintaining trails and fixing things where we need to. You can see how the money was distributed here. $300,000 came from the Game and Fish Fund. That's 3.9 of the 4.8 million from the general fund, representing 12%, and 87% from the Natural Resources Fund, coming from those specific user fee generated accounts. Madam Chair, if there's no questions, I'm going to move on to strategic objective number 2. Or would you like to spend some time on the table? Talking about accomplishments? Okay, we'll go to strategic objective number 2, plan, acquisition, and development. This is actually where we are planning once those segments are authorized in statute, looking at where they should be, acquiring them, developing them, renewing the land and facilities to meet the needs, especially recreational, environmental safety, and community needs. Budgeted 08-09 was $12.4 million. The other piece of that general fund, $900,000, is general fund or 8%, which was $750,000 of that was one-time money. Natural Resources Fund is $5.3 million or 42%. Federal funding that we received for trails in this biennium was $2 million or a little over 16%. Special Revenue Fund, $100,000, and then Game and Fish Fund, 32%. And a lot of the Game and Fish Fund activities, and most of them, Madam Chair, focus on those water wreck pieces of it, boat accesses, fishing piers, and things of that nature. Just specifically some of the things that we've done with that, if you look at the spreadsheet, in the past year we've acquired 13 miles of trails from seas through fee and easement from willing sellers, developed 39 miles of trail and one bridge up in the Baxter area, renewed 12 miles of trails and two bridges. We have four state trail master plans or amendments undergoing completion, strategic water recreation plan we're working on. On the safe harbor side of things, we completed the McQuaid Small Craft Harbor, and that was opened last summer, 2008. Acquired 15 parcels to provide newer expanded public access, and were developed or renewed 24 sites, including 8 cooperative water access projects. So, also in addition, bonding funds for this activity, since you go back to 2005, we've had $42.7 million in bonds that we use for these activities. $13.2 million are currently expended or under contract, and we'll be spending $24.4 million within the next year or so.
Here's the problem I'm seeing as I'm going over this. We don't have a context here. So... If you can just pick any one of these out. Number of access points acquired. You have 15 more, and you talk about how many do we have in total? What's the end game? Where are we? How long will it take us to get there? Without that kind of context, and it's hard to judge where we are.
Madam Chair, I do apologize that information is not on the table. A lot of that is in the conservation agenda. We'll make sure that in the final version of this table that is there, and that we talk about that as we look at 10 and 11. So that context is there, and you can understand, have a good understanding what the goals are of each of those programs. The final...
Representative Portman has a question. Well, just a quick question. On page 7, I kind of had a similar question to Representative Wagenia. Like for the non-motorized trails, we acquired 130 new state trail miles, or that's our plan by the end of fiscal 2009. It'd be good to know like a dollar per mile we're spending in this program. It seems like something we should look at so that we know what we're getting for the money that we put in. You're going to need a lot more information, and I would say that as you bring us the new budget with the spreadsheets like this, we can update some of that right in that new budget. I think maybe that would be the easiest way to do it. Is that all right?
Yes, ma'am, sir.
Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do we, and I know this may be difficult to measure, and maybe you've said this earlier, but do you have any idea of the usage of these different non-motorized, motorized, if there's been an increase over the past year, decrease, you know, statistics like that at all? Or?
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, we have use figures on any variety of activities. If you're just talking about state trails, I could answer that. If you everything from hiking to bicycling to ATVing, we've got all that information. I'd be happy to provide any of that. I know on the state trails, we frequently do surveys. Our surveys indicate that in actuality, some of our state trails are actually declining in use. And one of the theories behind that is we've done a good job of putting trails throughout the state. So now someone doesn't necessarily have to drive to Bemidji to utilize a state trail. There's trails everywhere. And maybe they're using those larger state trails just as the vacation spot. Overall, our surveys suggest that there are about 1.1 million different people that utilize a state trail on an annual basis.
descriptions and...
Madam Chair, it would be helpful if we could have a list of that, you know, so we have a better idea of if we're putting our dollars in the right place. I'm a frequent user of the state park trails and not other trails, and I always notice that I'm usually alone when it comes to that. So it just would be helpful to know where the usage is.
Madam Chair, we can provide that list for you.
As you look at your strategic objectives and your column, I don't think it's operations and maintenance is listed as an objective is one mindset. What Representative Anderson is bringing up is another one. And I think that we need to pursue the one that she is bringing up, because what is our outcome here? How many people are going on a trail? How many enjoy it? Is that? And our objective, it seems to me, that we have in common around this table, is we want more people on the trail using what we're providing. So as a measure, wouldn't that be the appropriate one? Strategic objective?
Yeah, sure. We can utilize that as a strategic objective for the 10-11 budget.
Well, let's back up. It's not that I necessarily want to see that on paper, but I do, and I think Representative Anderson is right. It is the mindset of what is our common strategic objective here. Is it to build it? Or is it to make sure people are using it and enjoying it and measuring their satisfaction? Am I getting at your question here? Yes. Okay, I remember the testimony from 2 years ago that struck this committee when we were hearing from people who were tourism operators. They had whatever. And they were saying the trails are not in good shape, people are not coming up here, wherever that fear was at the time. And so that's what made us start thinking more about trails and maintenance, because we were thinking of the strategic objective, I believe, of how many people were going to enjoy it, and that meant an increase in our tourism. Do you remember that, Representative McNamara? I think that was something you had been talking about, too. So...
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I do remember that from 2 years ago. And this gets to Representative Anderson's question, because my recollection is that the people that do hiking and walking were far excessive of the amount of money that we were putting into that part of the budget, whether it be for operations and maintenance or for purchase. I mean, it was a huge figure. We don't have that here today, and I was just looking through my things, but I did not keep my two-year-old information. But it would be nice to see that again, so that we can see, for instance, the non-motorized recreation state trails were spending 18%. And it's my recollection that that was just a huge number of people that utilized that, and maybe the 18% is not the accurate projection of what we should be spending in the future.
Do you have, just to give folks a little tiny bit of context right now, can you tell us those breakdowns? Because I think they're pretty simple. How many people go walking? And
yes, Madam Chair. We did a survey a few years ago, and it is our 10-year forecast of Minnesotans' recreation participation, 2004 to 2014. And it's actually looking at the numbers that we currently had in 2004 and then projecting them forward to 2014. We can make this particular survey or document, research document, available to you. But it really talks about some broad numbers. For instance, 54% of us Minnesotans hike. 29% of us Minnesotans utilize a bicycle trail. So there's a lot of those things in there, and then there's some very, very specific information about the trends. For instance, camping, if you look at the camping trend from now till 2014, it looks like that's going up. boating is about stable. ATVing is shown to be rising from between now and 2014 by 300%. So we have all of those particular categories in this document. I think it'd be, and this is what we used a few years ago when we presented the budget. So, Representative Scalzi, your recollection is accurate. We have the information. We just didn't provide it for our overview here today.
I think that's where we want to go. And we will, if we get a if you have extra copies of that, we will get them around to members before the next hearing, where we'll make some copies of it.
Madam Chair, members.
Anderson has a
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking for more specifics, the actual use of our current trails that we have, though. Because, you know, a lot of people say that they hike, but, you know, I've got a sister that says she's hiked, and she hasn't hiked in 5 years. So I'm just, you know, I want to actually know what the use is, not the wishful thinking.
Madam Chair, Representative, we have those figures as well. We do surveys on most of our state trails. It's kind of on a rotational basis, so it's not every year, every state trail. We're able to survey about two, sometimes three state trails on an annual basis, and then we would have those use numbers for that particular trail.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Madam Chair. And then you'll actually tell us what state parks that you're surveying and everything, too. Because I know some parks are more popular than others, and that would give me some, for me personally, it would give me some context to us. Okay, what are we looking at here? You know, a Sibley State Park that gets a lot of use is going to have a lot more than, say, Munson or some of those. So that would help me to understand, you know, who are we talking about here?
Madam Chair, Representative, we will have the information for state parks as well. What I've been focusing on is the state trails, but we have the information for state parks as well.
It would be helpful to have it for the entire trail system. Yes.
We'll pull together, Madam Chair, we'll pull together a map that shows the parks, the trails network that's out there, and we can also get into some of those regional trail systems that are not state trails, but that the legislature has supported and funded as well. So we can talk. It's a good path, no pun intended, that you're going down. So we can certainly talk about the system that's out there, what we project the future to be, and the needs and the usership that are out there, and the interconnectedness as well. So we appreciate the discussion. And just to go back, Madam Chair, to Representative Scalzi's question or statement about non-motorized funding is only 18%. It's 18% that the legislature has funded with general fund dollars, as the other 82% comes from the users that pay money into those accounts. So if I don't want it to sound like it's out of balance, because it's people who are paying in that 82% that are getting the services that they're paying for back to them. So that's just a discussion I think we need to have as well. What should the funding source be for non-motorized recreation, and how much should those dollars be?
The problem that we will all have in analyzing this is our economy has changed drastically, and over the next couple of years anyway, one can assume that people are not going to have as much money to spend on recreation. So they will be doing different things, and I think maybe one of our basic questions is the parks and trails ready for them. Do you want to continue?
Thank you, Madam Chair. The final objective in the Trails and Waterways Division that we have outlaid for you is the community assistance. And it kind of focuses on a lot of this discussion that we've been having. This is the area that we provide grants to encourage partnerships with local government units for trail and water recreational facilities for development, for maintenance and repair, for the operations of these. And it's working with those local units of government, your constituents, the people who are coming to your districts, your communities, and the areas that want these trail systems to draw in those people. This area focuses on, it's funded basically $21.6 million from the Natural Resources Fund and $6.9 million from federal funding. So there is no general fund attached to this. And this area is primarily in the area of grants. Through the grant programs, we administer about 360 grants per fiscal year. The programs include the Grant-Aid Snowmobile Trails, cross-country ski and ATV trails, as well as the Federal Recreation Trail Program and local and regional trail grants. These grants can be for maintenance and operations, capital improvements such as trail development, bridge replacements, public access, development, and equipment purchases. Do you have a question?
I think Representative Lilly has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just backing up for a second to the trail number counting question, kind of where we're going. I spent about 70 days last year on the Gateway Trail, and every day was different. So how do you count people? Some days you get passed by a swarm of bikes, and then they never come back. Some day you get passed, they're coming and going. Some days there's, you know, a lot of it's with weather, or, you know, you'll get a nice day and the world's out there, and the next day you get a little rain, or I don't know. Every day is different. How do you count people on these trails? I'm just curious.
Madam Chair, Representative Lilly, there is a science to it, and I'm not totally familiar, but it has something to do with being random. And so what they do when they do the surveys is they will be out there to survey, let's say, between a two-hour period, sometimes between 6 o'clock and 8 o'clock in the morning, and then on a different day between 8 and 10 and 10 and 12, and you get the picture. So various days of the week at various times of the day over a period of time, and then they through the statistical analysis, they can estimate the number of users that are out on any given facility.
Thank you. Well, this whole thing we are doing here today is really based in complaining about not having enough money, and we don't have enough. And it's not very random about aircraft registrations in the state. It's not very random about car registrations, truck registrations, pickup truck registrations, snowmobile registrations, ATV registrations. But yet we sit here and work around the edges on bicycles. And we don't have enough money to maintain the trails. They said they can't do the crack sealing and do some brushing and fiddle around here, kind of working around the edges. And, I don't hear any complaints about a $15 trail sticker per year that we pass for snowmobiles, of which there's nearly 270,000 roughly. And when it first happened, somebody said blah, blah, blah. But now, the Trails and Waterways Division has got the trails groomed so immaculately that everybody's ecstatic. So it would seem to me that one of the ways we get our handle around the numbers, at least, that Representative Lilly says, is to have a registration. And that we ought to be charging a fee for bicycles. Because what's the difference between a bike? Just because it doesn't have a motor doesn't mean that it doesn't have a cost associated with it, particularly to the state. And if snowmobilers and ATV users and off-road vehicle users and airplane users are all taxpayers, so are bicycle people. So we ought to be doing it. Where's the political will, Madam Chair?
Well, I think one of the issues you will find is that if you have an ATV, you probably have to go on a trail that's public. If you have a bicycle, you don't. And so that will be something that we will discuss. And if you bring a bill up, we're obviously going to put it on the table and discuss it.
Well, Madam Chair, I just have to respond that there's a lot of places that don't. There are more places to ride ATVs and snowmobiles off a trail than there are on a trail, but it still requires a registration.
I don't think that's the debate we're going to get into right now, but we will later. So if you will continue, again, I think what you can hear is the issue about what outcomes really are. Outcomes of people on the trails and how satisfied they are. Not how many miles we have. And how are we going to help this community, help this committee understand what those numbers are? Do you want to go ahead?
Sure. Thank you very much.
We have Representative Portman.
Sorry, just to conclude on that, not just the number of users and how satisfied they are, but the cost per user. Because we can tell to the penny what the state subsidy per user of Metro Transit or Greater Minnesota Transit is. So how much of this is user supported and how much is state subsidized? And I think there's a balance to strike. That's why we have general taxation. But we just want, we need to know what that balance is.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, that is a good piece of information that we need to have. We do have those kinds of figures, and we'll put that together for you. Like I said previously, we envision having a Trails 101 document with all of this stuff contained for us to have a more full discussion as we present the 10 and 11 budget and talk about those issues.
Well, as we talk about results for Minnesotans and we're budgeting for results, I think these questions should are naturally coming up, and there's just some missing information here. So, if you could go ahead.
Just quickly finishing up the community assistance. The activities here, this $28.5 million, is basically passed through to local units of government or groups through grant and aid trail system, grant and aid programs, with $16.8 million of those dollars, as Representative Dill was speaking of, for snowmobile trails, $2.1 million for ATV trails, $300,000 for off-highway motorcycles, a little bit more than $300,000 for off-road recreational vehicles, $1.3 million to local grants. And just on that local grant piece, I spoke about our local initiative grants. Through our trail grants program, we had in 2008 35 local trail connection projects that asked for funding, while only 9 received funding. We had $2.4 million of requests for $385,000 worth of funding. And on the regional side of things, we had 10 regional trail projects asking for money, with only 3 receiving funding, about $1.5 million of requests for $270,000 worth of funding. So there is a lot of need out there. And right now we're seeing about 83% of the projects that apply for dollars are not receiving funding. So we can provide more information on the requests on those trail grants that we've received as well, Madam Chair. If there's no other questions, we can move on to Fish and Wildlife. So just real quickly talking about our priority outcomes and measures. This slide shows our outcomes of public water access is acquired or developed along lakes or rivers. We've met our target. Right now, we have 1,595 public water accesses, and our goal was to establish, acquire or develop an additional 15, which we've done already to this day. So, and just going back to the measures, we didn't talk a lot about these on the spreadsheet, but we have been able to maintain our outcomes or reach our outcomes in this division by maintaining existing restorations. We did complete our forest inventory process. We were required to do that by December 31st, 2008 for all the state forests. We're done with that now. Talking about access points, we just talked about the 15 acquisitions. And then maintaining the number of sites developed on lakes and rivers in partnership with local units of government, that 12 co-op goal that we had, we have maintained with several hundred existing co-ops in existence, working with those local units of government for water access sites, fishing piers, and things like that.
Backing up to your last slide, and you have the column that says 1,600. Is that the overall outcome of the number of water accesses that you think are appropriate for this state?
Madam Chair, the goal of the public water access program is to have a free public access on any of our public lakes, which for the public access program is any lake that's over 150 acres in size. I don't remember what the exact number of lakes over 150 acres there are, but my guess is that it's in the thousands. And so we've got a lot of work to do with our public access program. The other thing I would suggest is that many of these lakes are very large in size, and they would deserve multiple public accesses. So one access that might provide 10 free car parking spots wouldn't serve a very large lake. And so the goal of the public access program, again, is to have free and public, free and adequate access to all public waters of the state. We focus on the largest lakes, the clearest lakes, and the lakes that have the best fish-sustaining capabilities.
Okay. But your chart then would be misleading, because I look at it and say, well, we're almost at our goal now at 1,600. So what we need is the context here what is your intended outcome overall? How far are we along in meeting that? So we can see if we think your long-term goal is the correct measure that we should be using for access, water access, or do we think it's different until we have that conversation? So that's the key issue here, and without that kind of information, we can't have a discussion about the key issue. Representative Anto.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question has to do with also with a public access program, but also the correlation between the construction and maintenance of public accesses and the fisheries program. Is there a correlation between state stocking programs and public accesses, and is it possible that there are lakes that benefit from state stocking program but do not benefit from having a public access?
Madam Chair, Representative Anzelk, that's an excellent question. The program, and I believe it even in statute, if not the program guidelines, are set such that we would not do any stocking unless the body of water had a public access.
Thank you.
Thank you. Do you, Mr. Bowe, do you build accesses that aren't for fishing access? For example, let's take Dutta.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, yes. We do some duck hunting accesses as well. But again, our priorities would be on the fish-sustaining capability lakes just because of the numbers of duck hunters versus the numbers of anglers. But we do work closely with our Division of Wildlife on those lakes that are popular for duck hunting, and we assist with that access program as well. The user, of course, is buying a boat registration, and so they don't differentiate between a duck lake or a fishing lake. Their expectation is that there's access to those public waters.
No follow-up?
Nope.
Okay. Any other questions on this section of DNR, members? I don't see any other questions. Do you want to go on to the next section?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I will bring down Director David Shad from the Fish and Wildlife Division to assist us in answering your question on this division. We're moving into the Fish and Wildlife Division, which has several strategic objectives, and you can see them outlined here on this slide. Fish and Wildlife Population Management, Fish and Wildlife Habitat Management, Technical Assistance, Planning, and Public Participation, Outreach and Department Programs, and Public Information and Customer Service. And just a side note to give you a little context here, we serve 2.1 million anglers, almost 600,000 hunters and trappers, and 2.2 million wildlife viewers. In addition, we work with 1,700 commercial fishery operators and over 2,000 resorts and related tourist businesses. Again, this is a rather complex budget if you peel apart that big purple slide or piece of the pie here. That 74% from the Game and Fish Fund is made up of numerous dedicated accounts that have specific authorizations for the spending purposes within statute, Madam Chair, and we'll talk a little bit about that as we move forward. But there's also another side of this funding mixture here with $2.1 million from the Environmental Trust Fund, or the LCCMR, for projects. Gift fund, $500,000 to match the Reinvest in Minnesota program, $7.1 million. Treaty payments are funded out of this program, and that's $15.8 million out of the general fund. General fund, these are biennial numbers, Madam Chair, just so people realize that, remind them of that. The general fund is $6.6 million, or 4%. Natural Resources Fund, $5.7 million. Federal funding, $5.6 million. The Special Revenue Fund of $3 million. And Madam Chair, this does include some one-time dollars from that, the previous biennium as well. Moving on to the next slide, budget by strategic objectives, actually by payment here. You can see as we move into these strategic objectives, 34% of those dollars, total dollars appropriated last biennium, or the biennium we're in, current biennium, was for fish and wildlife population management, or $63.3 million. 32%, or $58.2 million, was for fish and wildlife habitat management. And then technical assistance, planning participation, $21 million. Outreach and department programs, $4.6 million. Public information and customer service, $17.7 million. And then the treaty payments are $15.8 million. If there's no other questions, we'll move right into the first strategic objective for fish and wildlife. And this really is dealing with the populations of animals that we have out there, fish and wildlife that are out there. The goal is to support healthy and productive fish and wildlife populations and provide high quality and abundant fishing, hunting, trapping, and wildlife recreation viewing. Just quickly, you can look at the budgeted expenditures or estimated budgeted expenditures. 94% of these funds, of the $63.3 million, come from the Game and Fish Fund, which again comes from the people buying hunting licenses, fishing licenses, a trout stamp, salmon, trout salmon stamp is the same thing, a pheasant stamp, a duck stamp, small game licenses, whatever it is. Those dollars are directed towards activities to maintain and enhance the fish and wildlife populations for those specific activities. Some supporting programs, let me finish off the funding here. $200,000 comes from the gift account, $1.6 million from the general fund, $1.2 million from federal funding, and $1.4 million from special revenue funds.
Representative Hansen has a question before you go on.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Commissioner Meyer. On the Game and Fish Fund, is the authority for expenditures with game and fish only for species that have a season that are regulated as game and fish, or can the Game and Fish Fund be spent on wildlife in general?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, for the record, Dave Shad, and Fish and Wildlife Director for DNR. The Game and Fish Fund is required by statute, and also there's some federal conditions associated with grants that we receive for excise taxes that the federal government collects on hunting and angling equipment, that it be used for fish and wildlife programs. It doesn't require that they're game and fish or hunted and angled species, and so we can use those funds broadly for fish and wildlife conservation.
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, when you get to the specific accounts within the Game and Fish Fund, which is it's a rather complex part of our budget, but every account, if you look in statute, has specific authorities associated with it. So the pheasant stamp account, for example, has specific spending abilities. You can only spend it on certain programs. So I think that's getting to the part of your question and what you're asking there. We have broad authority to spend dollars in the overall fund, but then the individual accounts do have spending qualifications on them.
Madam Chair, thank you. As a follow-up, part of where I'm going on this is on the constitutional dollars and the Outdoor Heritage Fund, which I believe says game, fish, and wildlife, has the same broad requirement or authority. It's not specific to only game and fish species, but it's also to wildlife. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, on the Game and Fish Fund dollars or on the constitutional dollars? Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, you are correct. It's game, fish, and wildlife. And also, just as a side note, this is a lot of the areas in our budget have multiple activities have multiple benefits. So the dollars and the programs that we're investing on, say, shallow lakes or prairie restoration, riparian land acquisition, provide that nesting ground for other non-game species as well. So it's maintaining that healthy ecosystem, that healthy population balance. And the hunters and fisher people of the state are providing multiple benefits for multiple species of wildlife. So there's a lot of crossover in what we have here. Also, a lot of the activities we do have substantial water quality benefits as well. So
since nature is so complex and we don't understand it very well, keeping a healthy aquatic ecosystem, I think, is extraordinarily difficult. when I see that crappies love carp eggs, then I like crappies a lot better than before I knew that. So I think our understanding is at least mine is weaker than it should be in this area, but I think in general we all don't know what it takes to maintain a healthy ecosystem, and that's why we have girly fish. What do you all do about that?
Madam Chair, members, about the endocrine disruptor issue?
Yeah, now that we've brought up the health of aquatic systems and you're going to try to maintain on a sustained basis. I hadn't thought of that until you all just put this on the table.
Madam Chair, we understand that to have healthy fisheries, healthy fish populations, we need clean water, we need healthy aquatic habitat, and there are many measures of that, you know, water clarity, for example, the presence of aquatic vegetation and habitat for fish to breed and raise their young in. The issue of endocrine disruptors is one that, and chemical contamination of waters is one that we have kind of a limited ability to influence. We can do some things through habitat, through some of our programs, provide buffers and that sort of thing to minimize runoff, for example. But in many cases, the chemicals that are causing some of these problems are beyond our division's ability to control. In fact, they're beyond our department's ability to control. But certainly, when our lake surveys, for example, pick up some of those problems, we notify the appropriate agencies and let them know that there's a concern there. Madam Chair, you might be aware of the long-term monitoring program that we've established. We call it the Sustaining Lakes in a Changing Environment. LCCMR has recommended funding for that program, where we'd like to set up some long-term monitoring programs on some lakes around the state to start to detect some of these changes that are occurring in those lakes as a result of changes in the watershed, changes, development patterns, climate change, all the things that influence these aquatic systems. We need to be able to pick up what those changes are and then try to link it back to what that cause is, and that's a big reason why we're getting into that long-term monitoring for that very reason.
Sounds to me like you're closing the barn door after the horses left. Representative Purcell?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just to follow up on that same train of thought there, what you're describing, look at that precautionary or preventative PMDL type of stuff for nutrients, keeping it out, not just monitoring after it's already in there kind of a deal?
Yes, Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's an important part of this. And we do have our fishery staff very involved working with our staff from Division of Waters, Ecological Resources, PCA, and Bowser on the clean water and the impaired waters piece, both in helping detect but also developing some of those remediation approaches to try to clean up the impairments that are affecting some of those waters.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Does PCA understand what water quality is necessary for a walleye whitefish fishery, for instance? Do you know that they can tell you what phosphorus concentration the steady state of the lake needs to be?
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative, yes. And we work very closely with PCA on those types of issues, and more so now with the clean water legacy program and the whole impaired waters program. I think it's kind of forced the water people and the natural resource people to work together and tackle these problems together, more so than we ever have in the past.
Excuse me, one more follow up. Are these laid out in a management plan then? You have a target, say, for Millax Lake, or Pickle Lake. We're going to maintain the phosphorus concentration of that lake within, by a couple of parts per billion of 15 or something.
Madam Chair, Representative, we do have individual management plans for each of the lakes that we manage the fishery there. We do, in our lake surveys, monitor water quality, and if there's a problem with water quality that we pick up or detect as part of those lake surveys, we certainly work with Pollution Control Agency on
it. I'm sorry. I'm trying to get at. I'm going back now. You're coming back to where Chairwoman Wiginius ended up, and that is, once you know it's in there, it's too late.
Right.
That's where I'm coming from. If you've got phosphorus overloading the system, it's there until it sediments out, geochemically makes rock.
Right.
And it's recycle. It's about prevention. That's how quick.
The concern I hear, two concerns. I have two concerns when I listen to you. One is you are waiting till the horse is out. But the second concern is you, as you talk about TMDLs, and that's 1970 science. This is 2009. And so if we are still worried about 1970 science and haven't grappled with the things that we know in 2009, we're 39 years behind.
And Madam Chair, we've long recognized that these water quality issues and problems are important for fisheries. We have developed programs over the years, for example, shoreline restoration programs. We've worked with communities. We've had watershed specialists out to work with communities, work with landowners to address some of these landscape level problems that are occurring out there. But quite frankly, the resources that we've been able to put towards those kinds of activities have been pretty limited. And you're right, we are losing the battle in many parts of the state. It's not that we don't know what we need to do. It's been an issue of resources, I think, more than anything.
Perhaps it's also an issue of raising the alarm, because if Minnesotans don't understand what the problem is, their solution is only going to be, oh, let's stock the lake some more. And when I hear people say that, what I understand is they haven't talked about our healthy waters, or our lack of health in our waters. So as I look at your strategic objectives, it's a great one. Maintain wildlife populations maintained on a sustained basis. I think we have to have some additional measures here to make sure that that's happening. You want to go on?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Talking about the supporting programs, lake and stream assessments and surveys, monitoring, we talked a little bit about population research. Fisheries permitting activities are also coordinated out of this area, culturing and stocking, fish and wildlife disease monitoring, capture and release, depredation issues, season management, regulation, and information systems. And if you move to the spreadsheet on page 9, we've done our best to try to pull together some high-level kind of contextual outcomes and goals for this division, these activities here. And they focus on a number of different issues, just starting at the top, hunter satisfaction levels, trying to maintain a 90% satisfaction level that has gone down on our last survey, so we need to come back and do some more work and resurvey there. You can see in 2007 that we had a 70% satisfaction rating. Looking at chronic wasting disease, I'm sure an issue that we've talked about here recently in the policy committee. In 2008, we sampled a total of 14,050 deer. No CWD positive cases have been detected. In this area, we've met and exceeded, I should say, our 95% of our surveillance goal. We've also done, on that issue, extensive work with bovine tuberculosis on testing and deer removal in the bovine TB area. We talked a little bit about that in the policy committee. We're also going to be talking about that in the Ag committee here Wednesday afternoon, about what we've been doing in cooperation with local units, the government, landowners, and Department of Ag and the Board of Animal Health to help eradicate that disease. The rest of this is population data. We can go into a little bit if you're interested, Madam Chair.
I think one of the things you need to talk to the committee about is the money from the Game and Fish Fund that is used, Representative Bill, is used for chronic wasting disease and bovine tuberculosis. I don't know that deer are bovine, so are we now not subsidizing that area?
Madam Chair, members, we do have we have a draft spreadsheet that we've been working on in response to some questions from the policy committee, but we can talk in general about those numbers right now, and as we come back in 10 and 11, provide you more in-depth detail, or would you rather have the complete discussion at that point in time?
We can have the complete discussion in that time, but I think members of the committee should know that there is money going from the Game and Fish Fund that perhaps is going inappropriately.
Madam Chair, the governor's budget does have funding for these activities out of the general fund to help us increase those activities in the next biennium as well, which we'll talk about at that point in time. So just, I'm going to highlight a couple of these targets here. VHS, we've tested 64 waters in conjunction with USDA and APHIS, including 40 hatchery waters. We're on the process to test all of those waters we need to in a timely fashion and meet those goals as well. If you look at Lake Superior steelhead trout catch rates and spawning numbers, our goal was to maintain an average catch rate of 0.06 to 0.10 for steelhead greater than 16 inches per angler, and actually we're at 0.147 or 6.8 hours per fish. So we're meeting our targets, partly responsible through our management techniques. If you look at the percentage of wild lake trout in the recreational fisheries of Lake Superior, we're maintaining those goals, I believe, but percent of wild lake trout survey has increased from 8% in 1985 to 75% in 2007. I'm just going to pick a couple of these other highlights in case, unless anybody has any other questions. If you look at the success on Red Lake, our goal is to maintain a self-sustaining walleye population with mature females exceeding 2 pounds per acre. Our goal, where we're at right now, is over 4.5 pounds per acre in 2008. The age structure is gradually becoming more diverse, and consistent natural reproduction has been documented for 5 consecutive years. We're no longer stocking that fishery. It's been a huge success to where that has gone and how the population has sustained itself. If you look at just pounds of walleyes and fingerling stock, our goal was to maintain or set 160,000 pounds of walleye fingerlings for each leap year. 2008, it was 160,594, 169,000 in 2007, 168,000 in 2006. This is a difficult goal to achieve at some point in time based upon weather, the availability of stock or fingerlings, walleye fry to stock at that point in time, but we're doing our best to maintain those levels. Moving on, talk about present harvest levels. The latest data we have is two. I'm sorry, Madam Chair.
Representative McNamara has a question.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. Director Meyer, this would be consistent with my forestry questions. Can you provide the committee with the information in regards to, you noted how you sometimes have trouble, or Director Bowe, just give us the information on the fingerlings and fry that you're buying from the private and what you're paying and what your estimated costs are to provide those. And if we're having trouble meeting the goal, maybe we're not using the private sector enough. And again, I would question if that's a core duty job of the DNR and if maybe we should focus our resources somewhere differently. We could get that information, Madam Chair.
Get that information. I think maybe then you have to ask the previous question too. If we're having to stock a lake, we look at the ideal of Red Lake. Consistent natural reproduction has been documented for 5 consecutive years. Seems to me that that is a great goal. Stocking walleye says that we're not meeting those goals on other lakes. So it is a goal that says we're failing on some lakes, I think. So we have to be talking about that. Representative Anzell, I think you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
My question also has to do with walleye stocking, but it's more in line with, can you give us a couple of comments about what the science tells us about the various factors involved that allows a publicly hatched walleye that is stocked in Lake A to eventually reproduce on its own versus a stocked walleye from another public hatchery that does not reproduce on its own in another lake?
Madam Chair, Representative Anza, we stock walleyes in kind of two different situations broadly. One is the supplement natural reproduction in the lake to provide additional angling opportunity to kind of even out those highs and the lows over time that you invariably see in some of these natural systems. So that's one situation. The other situation is we do stock some lakes merely to provide fishing opportunity. These aren't lakes that are well suited for natural walleye reproduction, and so it's basically a put and take fishery. We're simply putting those fish, letting them grow, and the anglers catch them and enjoy them.
Just to follow up, Madam Chair, thank you for the second part of the answer. What I'm driving at is the state's policy should be to create more opportunity in more bodies of water, especially with an eye toward the mortality issue on bigger bodies of water with bigger fish in the hot summer months, which is really an irritation to this angler and virtually every angler that I relate to. The mortality rate on big bodies of water in the heat of the summer. We're losing a lot of fish that are released in a way that does not allow that resource to live. And that really bothers me.
And Madam Chair, Representative Anzell, you're referring to some of the slot limits that we've got on most of our large walleye lakes.
Yes.
And where we protect fish, the most common regulation would be a slot of 18 to 26 inches where fish within that slot need to be released. And we're in the process of kind of reassessing that approach to that slot limit. We've had some of these in place for 10 years or more, although many of them are more recent than that, and we're starting to learn more about how those slots really affect those fish communities, and having a lot of big fish in those systems in some cases a good thing. People can catch a lot of those fish and re-catch them and that sort of thing, and we need a certain number of those big breeding fish to support that fishery out there. But in some cases we think what might be happening is these systems that are dominated with a lot of big fish, those big fish need to eat a lot, and a lot of times they're eating small walleyes and kind of disrupting what would be a more natural situation in these lakes. So we're learning, and as we learn, we'll probably be relooking at some of those approaches with slot limits.
Thank you very much for that,
Representative Gill.
Thank you. On the versus what Representative McNamara was talking about, your fish hatchery business and the public, the private, is there a difference between the walleye? Is there something genetic? Is there some, what is the reason why you buy some from them and you do some, and they say that their capacity is way more than they're being used for, and what is that all about? Is there some mystical, magical reason why we do it the way we do it?
Madam Chair, Representative Bill, we several years ago, I'm not sure the year, but we did in the past the walleye stocking that we did was exclusively with state reared walleyes. We wasn't that long ago that we didn't
purchase any fish from the private sector. Several years ago, it was probably 5 to 7 years ago, we actually started to purchase fish from the private sector, increased that. Right now, we're buying, of that 160,000 pounds per year, we're purchasing 40,000 pounds from the private sector, and we're looking to continue to ratchet that number up. As far as the cost for privately reared fish versus our cost to raise fish, we're actually assessing those numbers. We hope to have a really good, solid analysis done by Minnesota Management and Budget on those costs within the next couple of weeks, anticipating that this issue would come up. The fish that they're raising are very high-quality fish. We have very stringent requirements in our contract as far as the size of those fish, the genetic origin of those fish, and we're getting a very good product from the private sector. We agree that we don't necessarily need state employees out there raising fish, that if there is that capability in the private sector, we're getting a good product for a good price, that there's no reason why we shouldn't continue to kind of ratchet that up in the private sector and ratchet it down as far as something that DNR is doing directly. I think there is some balance that we probably want to maintain over time. For example, if we put all of our eggs in the private sector business and a market develops elsewhere in the country for those fish, we may be unable to attain some of our stocking goals. And that's something we need to work through with the industry. We don't want to be held hostage, so to speak, and not be able to achieve what we need to do as far as stocking programs. But I think those are all things we can work out, I think.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And I have two questions. The first one would be, as you're doing your assessment of the cost, are you also, as a part of that, assessing the cost to the resource? I mean, I don't know your raising techniques versus the private sector's raising techniques. Is this detriment to the water, and what types of waters are used, whether you're using ponds or if you're using a natural water? So that should be part of your assessment. But then my other question is, as people are raising walleyes, the private sector, as I understand it, and correct me if I'm wrong, can import feeding fish for those walleyes without having a VH testing. Is that accurate, or is that not accurate?
Madam Chair, Representative Scalzi, to your first question, the analysis that we're doing is purely looking at the cost of raising fish. The other issue that you raised as far as how those fish are reared is a really important one. And from the state standpoint, the fish that we raise, we tend to do it on a pretty extensive basis. We put the fry in the wetlands across the state, and then kind of let them go. Come back in the fall, see what's in there as far as these larger fingerlings, net them out, and that's what we use for stocking. So we use a large acreage of wetlands in the hopes that across all those wetlands we're going to get enough pounds to meet our needs. The private sector tends to take a different approach. They use a smaller number of basins, a smaller number of ponds, and they manage them more intensively. And as you know, we were provided funding this current biennium to develop some best management practices. We contracted with the University of Minnesota and the University of St. Thomas to work with us, work with some of our scientists, some of the stakeholders to develop those BMPs. We're still very early in that process, but I think those BMPs will be very important. I would anticipate, for example, that we could build in those BMPs into a future contract for purchasing fish, where fish raised and purchased by the state would have to be raised in such a way that's consistent with those best management practices. So I think we're moving in that direction to ensure that whether we're raising the fish or whether the private sector is raising the fish, that it's done as sustainably as possible. I forgot your second question.
Sure. The second question was as I understand it, the private sector is able to import feeding minnows to raise walleyes without VHS testing, whereas we are requiring VHS testing for people who bring in minnows for resale. So the difference between bringing in minnows for resale, are they tested for VHS, versus bringing in minnows, importing minnows for feeding, for raising walleyes.
Madam Chair, Representative Salzy, the only minnows that we allow to be imported into the state are those used for feeding, for fish hatchery operations or fish rearing purposes. We don't allow other minnows to be imported into the state. I'm not sure about the VH testing requirement. I know there's a permit required to import those minnows. I'm not sure if the testing that's taking place, but I can get back to you on that.
Please get back to us on that second question. I think that's, mm-hmm. that's critical.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
If you can hang on for a minute. Representative Salzy's first question was extremely important. If you're doing a cost just on finances without looking at what is happening to our resource, then that's not a legitimate, that makes no sense. You have to have both the dollar spent and the cost put on our resource from two types of raising fish. So I hope when we get that report back, it is something that actually we can use because it incorporates all the costs. So, Representative, did you have a question, Representative?
Yeah, I have to ask two more.
Two more. Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Tell me about that. You were on eggs a few minutes ago. How do they get their eggs, and how do you get your eggs, and can you let them collect eggs like you do? I think there's a difference. And my second question, and these are walleye eggs, obviously, not chicken. And the second one is the commercial growers tell me that the head count, the number of fish per pound that they give you is one thing, and that the number of fish per pound that you stock is another thing, and that your fish are eating their fish. And that doesn't sound very, if that's true, that doesn't sound very efficient. And because your fish are bigger than theirs, and since they eat on the little ones, you already said that once. Is that true? So, two questions.
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, on the first issue, they do have their own breeding stock and can collect their own eggs, and they generally know what the genetics are of those. If they don't have the right genetic stock to produce the fish that we need in a particular lake or in a particular area of the state, they can purchase the fry or purchase the egg from our hatcheries for that purpose. And we've got that process pretty well worked out. And it's maintaining that its genetic integrity of stocking fish with the right genetic makeup in the right lake is very, very important. As far as the numbers per pound, this is an issue that we've been talking a lot about with some of the anglers with an interest in our stocking program and with the industry. Because of this extensive approach we take to raising fish, where we put these fish in a number of wetlands, we're kind of at the mercy of Mother Nature. And for example, if we get a pond that we use one year and that pond doesn't winter kill, and those walleyes that are remaining from that fall harvest carry over through the winter and are still there in the spring when we put the fry back into that system, what happens is we end up with a lot of very large fish that are harvested the following fall, and that's not necessarily the best way approach to stocking. Our objective is 15 to 20 fingerlings per pound. You can actually see in the spreadsheet on page 10 there, where the walleye stocking indicator, the number in parentheses is the number of fingerlings per pound. So, for example, in 2008, We've stocked 160,594 pounds. They average 22.8 finger lengths per pound, which is a little higher than that 15 to 20 per pound average. So those fish were actually a little smaller than we would have preferred. That compares to 2007, where it was 169,000 pounds, but only 13 fish per pound. That followed a winter where we didn't have very much winter scale, and those fish ended up to be too big. We do tend to get a better and more consistent product from the private sector in that 15 to 20 per pound range, and that's, again, a result of their more intensive practices on their ponds. One reason why we'd like to continue to increase that poundage that we're buying from them.
And Chair, I got to ask, I'm back to Representative Scalzi, because this is bothering me now. We've worked, we've been battling and agreeing and everything on these minnows and these ponds. But, Mr. Chad, you said that you don't allow importation of minnows. But yet the dealers are telling me they import minnows into the state and then they repackage it and send them out. Is that true? And because you do allow importation, but only for resale out of the state. I don't want anybody to think that we don't bring minnows into the state from out of state. And secondly, is, do you have any problem with the ones that get imported in that don't get imported out?
Madam Chair, Representative Dill, I'm going to have to get back to you on that. I'm not real sure about the import for purposes of export again, and I'll have to talk to our enforcement folks to see if there are issues associated with that.
Okay. Madam Chair, just real quickly on that, it is an issue, as you may hear, some of you folks, that some people are saying there's a shortage of minnows out there, and with the VHS testing and the increase of that going on with Wisconsin and some of our other border states, people are more reluctant to sneaking minnows into the state. So a big part of our minnow shortage is that people are sneaking in less minnows for resale in the state of Minnesota, and also because of the supply and demand. The past couple winters haven't been good ice fishing winters, so people weren't raising a lot of minnows. We had a great early ice fishing season, so there was a lot of demand for bait fish early on. We can talk more about this in your committee, Representative Dill, if you'd like, but what we're seeing is that bait dealers are less reluctant, which is a good thing, to break the law, and are bringing in less bait into the state of Minnesota for illegal sale. So that's part of the problem we're seeing right now.
With that, members, it's past 10. We're going to recess, and we will be back here at 30. That's right.
Welcome back.
Madam Chair, thank you very much.
I think we should get started because everybody just wants to get home this evening, and when there's so few people here, there will be fewer questions.
I'm talking too fast. You just left me, all right?
But the people here can ask more questions.
And that is a good thing, Madam Chair.
So you are loaded for bear, Representative Ansel?
I'm docile.
Not very
docile. Loaded for bear.
Mr. Mayor.
Madam Chair, members, thank you very much. I think we'll move into strategic objective number 2, if that's okay with you.
Yes.
Trying to organize my various stacks of paper here. As you can see, for strategic objective 2, it's Fish and Wildlife Division. This focuses on fish and wildlife habitat management. Before, we were talking about the actual birds, the animals. This talks about the places that they live, basically. The goal here is to conserve and restore fish wildlife habitat, to provide access to high quality, abundant fishing, hunting, trapping, and wildlife recreation opportunities. Again, if you look at the funding breakout for 08-09, approximately $58 million, of which 71%, or almost $41 million, came from the Game and Fish Fund. The variety of other sources include Environmental Trust Fund at $2.1 million, the gift account at $200,000, the RIM Reinvest in Minnesota account at $7.1 million, and I believe that's the license plate dollar. The general fund at $3 million or 5%, natural resources fund at $0.01 million, federal funding at $3.6 million, and the special revenue fund at $1.3 million. Supporting programs under this objective include the Aquatic Plant Management Program, habitat acquisition, wildlife management areas, aquatic management areas and such, Dream Lake wildlife area habitat improvement, such as the Shallow Lakes Management Program, also habitat research, assessment, and monitoring. Madam Chair, members, if you go to your spreadsheet, on page 11 on the top there, you can see how this is broken out under that strategic objective. I'm going to move over to the FY target, FY08-09 targets and the key indicators and measures. If you look at just number of acres protected in wildlife management areas, our goal for the biennium was to acquire 8,000 acres per year. We did acquire 6,000 acres, and it's actually FY07-08, Madam Chair. We acquired 6,400 acres in 07 and 6,482 acres in 08. Currently, we have 1.3 million acres of wildlife management areas in the system. The long-term goal is to acquire an additional 700,000 acres, roughly. This comes from the Citizen Advisory Committee, and that goal is to be between, I think it's supposed to be 2002, Madam Chair, and 2052, not 2202. We'll fix that. Yes?
Just a moment. Representative Hansen has a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Meyer. And so these numbers are your existing plan that doesn't take into account passage of the constitutional amendment. Is that correct?
For the record, Dave Shad, Director of Fish and Wildlife Division. Madam Chair, Representative Hansen. Yeah, these numbers, these goals are based on a Citizens Advisory Committee process that concluded in 2002. And they recommended adding 702,000 acres. The short-term target, the 8,000 acres per year that we had for this current two-year biennium, was based on our estimate of what we might see for possible funding that might be available to acquire lands under that program.
Madam Chair and Director Shad, now it appears that there are processes going on to make recommendations through various stakeholder groups to come for the outdoor heritage dollars, which would be looking at habitat acquisition, wetlands, prairies, fish, and wildlife habitat. Can you maybe just, what's the department's role? And I mean, are you participating in some of those stakeholders? Are you leading a stakeholder group? Do you have your own initiatives that relate into this pie chart or your future plans? Could you maybe just help us out there?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we've been very involved in providing information to the council. First and foremost, we made a series of presentations at the last council meeting on existing plans, programs to deliver conservation out on the landscape. And then we've been very active participants in supporting some of these collaboratives that have formed to develop proposals that will be provided to the council. Both in terms of staff support, we've been asked by some of the organizations that are leading these collaboratives to provide facilitation and planning support and meeting organization support and that sort of thing. So we've been assisting in that manner, but we've also been sending our program staff there with ideas and projects and programs that we're aware of that the group might want to consider bringing forward in front of the council. So our programs, our projects, our plans are part of the discussions that are taking place out there, and I expect that they will be reflected in these proposals that come in front of the council starting on Monday.
Thank you. Then to follow up, so a project that could come forward, you're providing technical expertise to stakeholders on whether it works or not. That can come forward. The council makes recommendations. The legislature comes back here that we can rely, we can ask you questions then when a bill comes back here as to does this work, what was your advice, what's reality, what isn't reality. All of those questions could come through as it comes into the legislative process after it's gone through the recommendation filter.
And Chair Representative Hansen, that's correct. might also add, we've got, of course, field staff that work, you know, on the ground around the state with all of these programs. They work with all of our partners, and they're also very aware of some of the opportunities out there as far as shovel-ready projects, for example, and are very involved in delivering those things, and we'll certainly do whatever we need to do to make sure whatever programs and projects are funded by the council or funded by the legislature, recommended by the council, funded by the legislature, get on the ground in the best possible manner.
So there will not be a agency bill that will come to the council on recommendation from the DNR for outdoor heritage dollars. Would that be correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Hansen, we're working under the direction provided by the council and working through these collaboratives that have formed. And at this point, I wouldn't expect a separate standalone DNR proposal will come before the council.
On that note, we talk about these groups that are meeting. Are all these meetings publicly noticed?
Madam Chair,
you may not know the answer to that, but perhaps when we and that's really not that's not fair to you to ask you that question, but I think perhaps when Mr. Topor comes to visit us on Thursday, that is a question I want to ask. Because I've been hearing about all these groups that are meeting and making decisions, and if they're not publicly noticed, then we have a major problem on our hands. When I'm looking at your accomplishments and how many acres you have and your additional goals, I don't have any problems with the acquisition goals, but I don't see here how much of this has been restored to high quality, how much has been restored to medium quality, how much has not been restored. Help us out there. Do you have a chart that you can give us that talks about the level of restoration, and is it of the quality that we could use later on for quality biofuels, or where are we in that? Because we certainly talked about that last year in the last budget.
Madam Chair, it's a work in progress, I would say. The wildlife management area system that we've been acquiring over about 58 years now, since 1951. For probably the first four decades of that program, most of the focus was just on acquiring the land, and not a lot of effort on development. Certainly wetlands were restored, and there were things done like that, but we know a lot more about what we need to do as far as restoring prairie land, restoring prairie specifically, and also I think we're getting more refined and developing better approaches towards restoring wetlands as well. And so we are in the process of kind of determining what those needs are on a wildlife area by wildlife area basis. We're developing some management plans for each unit that assess kind of the current condition and then what the management needs are over time to bring those lands up to a very managed condition. Our goal with these areas would be to have these be kind of the best of the best habitats out there as far as habitat quality, diversity, and that sort of thing. And like I say, we do have a long way to go there. And we're in the process of kind of documenting the acres, the cost, that kind of thing that would be required.
Well, I think you'll find that we share the goal.
Mm-hmm.
So then the question is how we can see where we are,
mm-hmm.
and where we need to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's something that this committee will want to see. I think the goal is a goal in common. And that's good. It makes life easy. Rather than if you don't have share a goal in common. So let's see if we can have some outlines of that. And I am assuming that the Heritage Council would, and maybe my assumption is wrong, and maybe Representative Hansen can help me with this, but if we have all these state lands that need to be beefed up so they're really good for wildlife, they're really good for game, which is what we want, and my guess is you probably have things you could get ready on the ground this summer, or of course you don't have any money this summer, but as soon as money would become available. I am hoping that the Heritage Council is looking at that very issue so I think we need to have that at least an outline from you about how much you have and what shape. It doesn't have to be precise, but in rough terms it would be very helpful. Would that be helpful, Representative Hansen?
Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We'll provide that in our comments back to the committee.
Okay. We have two questions yet. Representative Scalzi and then Representative Kunin.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. And Mr. Shedd, regarding, and I don't know if this is the right place to ask this question, but you can direct me to ask it in a different area, but regarding acquiring acres, and I understand this is WMA's, but, you know, the 2005 legislature directed that lands be sold, and now I'm assuming with this new money coming in that we'll be directing you to buy, and that's in your long-term goal. So then how do we reconcile that with selling and buying? Will we be buying from ourselves, or how are we going to make sure that we have the habitat lands that we need in the future if we are in fact selling some?
And Madam Chair, Representative Salisbury, as a department, working through and looking across our total land base, not just at wildlife management areas, but state forest lands and even state park lands, to look to see if there are surplus lands that are no longer serving their intended purpose. They're not providing habitat, they're inaccessible to the public, that sort of thing. And in many cases, for the purposes of meeting the general fund reduction, the land sale target for the general fund target, many of those lands that we're targeting for sale are actually lands that we acquired through transfer from another state agency. For example, they might have been state hospital lands that were surplus to that system, and so we took them over and have managed those as open space or wildlife lands. If there are lands that were acquired with lands appropriated for wildlife management purposes from license fees, certainly lands that were donated to us by conservation organizations, that sort of thing, even if those, they might be surplus, but we wouldn't sell those for purposes of the general fund shortfall. But we may end up selling those and using the proceeds to buy better, higher quality lands that better meet our mission. So.
Madam Chair, just on that note, we are engaged fully in what we call strategic land asset management throughout the state, looking at county by county what land types we do own, what lands the counties own, and other ownerships, and trying to exchange where it makes sense to consolidate land holdings, to liquidate some of those lands. One of the areas that we're working with is in Representative McNamara's district. He understands the nature of the issues there about encroachment and development and trying to get higher quality lands. And what we really need to be focusing on are what are the lands that we want to have large tracts of high quality conservation lands that provide the best value for not only habitat, water quality, biofuels, but not isolated small tracts. We should be thinking about, you know, the largest amount of lands that we can. Our working lands initiative that we discussed last night, and we'll talk about a little bit more later on, talks about 4 to 9 square mile complexes of land that, are really the best for all sorts of habitats. And it doesn't all need to be owned by the state. It can still be in production. It can be under different types of easement programs. But really providing those large box of conservation opportunities is kind of the way we look at it, is where we need to be going. When we have a 15-acre piece, a 20-acre piece that was acquired by some means, we need to look at those and make sure we're managing the best lands we can, either putting the money back into land acquisition account, as Director Shad said, for acquisition of new WMAs, or trying to deal with the legislative mandate that the balance is about $4 million on from the land sales of 2005 and 2007. And we could provide the committee an update on where we're at with that at any time, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I'm not sure if I came in a little late. I apologize for that. I'm curious in terms of both game fish as well as non-game wildlife, and also looking at plants and other biodiversity, what sort of criteria there are, sort of prioritizing which lands to purchase. I know you talk about high-quality lands, and I appreciate that, but you know, I know there's a bunch of different, in biodiversity conservation, there's different ways of assessing it, looking at hot spots, kind of where there's unique species or important bird areas. The Audubon Society was in my office talking about important bird areas in our state, and or looking at certain ecosystem services, or even looking at climate change adaptation as we think about our current protected area system and how our trees and our plants and our insects and our birds are all moving around related to different climate, and how we might need to be thinking about how to connect them and facilitating that movement. So I'm just curious what sort of criteria you have to talk about high quality lands and also managing for what kind of outcomes, I guess, criteria. If you could, and we can talk about this more later, but just as kind of a general explanation.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Representative Knuth, we're, I think, getting a lot better at targeting and being more strategic about the lands that we purchase, rather than kind of scattergunning our conservation across the landscape and being kind of opportunistic. We're really trying to use, for example, GIS technology, some of the modeling that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and others have developed to really look and see where we can get the most bang for the buck, where, for example, there's some existing wetland and grassland complex where through some acquisition or some easement work or some targeted outreach to private landowners, we can leverage the existing investments and the existing resources that are out there. And kind of add the pieces that are missing and really develop a complex, as Commissioner Meyer said, that really has value to fish and wildlife and also more value for recreation. And we are, I think, increasingly thinking about some of the issues that you mentioned as far as where we do our conservation. We've also developed some fairly stringent criteria that we run these proposed acquisitions through, and there's such things as if they have some existing high quality prairie or some existing quality resources, it's certainly more cost effective to conserve that rather than have to come back later and restore it, and so that's one example of how we prioritize some of the acquisition work that we do.
Madam Chair, and Mr. Bo, right, Chad, sorry, I was the one before you. And if I could see some of those criteria, that would be really helpful. I'd be really interested in how you do that.
I think that would be good to share with the whole committee, and we will get it out. Representative
Jill? Yes. Well, there's an awful lot of talk about buying land here tonight, and boy, we don't have any money. And and the governor's budget cut Sustainable Forest Initiative Act, capped at $100,000. Got four landowners that own 1 million acres, and we're going to tell them no dice now after we signed the deal. We got a cut and pilt, 20% proposed. Madam Chair, I'd like for you to say it, but I haven't heard you say in this committee what you told me and what we agreed on about that legacy money and how it should be used and how it should be reserved. I'll say it if you'd like. I'll repeat it, and I'll use it as my idea.
Okay.
If this legacy spends money to buy land, you better put the tilt money and reserve it until the end of that authorization. And you better have a way to have a plan and the money reserved out of that legacy money for restoration, exactly what everybody in this place is talking about. It's not very often Representative Wagenius, I agree on everything. But the third thing that we agreed on was is that the DNR's got to do a lot better job of keeping track of the agreements that we have. And I know you're working on it in terms of easements, legal easements, you know, and agreements. But, I mean, maybe that's already been said, but, I mean, you're looking at people that got millions of acres, two of us, that got millions of acres of land that all you folks get to use. We're glad to have you come up there. But when we don't get our PILT money, and when Forest Capital owns 305,000 acres of land gets sold, that after you signed a deal for $8.21 an acre, we're now going to give you 30 cents an acre because we're short of money. Well, the people said they wanted to raise their taxes, even though the governor said they wouldn't. We better be thinking ahead and getting this all straightened out right off the front end. Otherwise, you're going to have problems and you're not going to have support.
Well, I think...
And it was your idea. I agreed with it.
Well, just so you guys know what we're talking about here. One of the things that Representative Dill and I have been talking about is that when you buy a piece of land, if you do not have all the money for the restoration and the long-term management in a package, then you're giving the state tails. Am I getting this? This is how we talked about it.
Yeah.
So it seems to me that to be fair to taxpayers, and because we can't have tails, that any time from now on we buy a piece of land, we should have that restoration package, quality restoration, because a quality restoration doesn't have as many weeds, it's better for our farmers, and it's easier to manage long term. We also talked about a long term management, money set aside for long term management. Now, we were talking about the new money that was coming in, but I think that's for any old money and new money. The PILT payments are a little bit different because we've always used general fund money for that, and I don't know whether the new money could be used for that or not. It's a constitutional question, but I don't think there's any constitutional question whether for each piece of land we purchase from now on has to have money to do restoration and the long-term management. There's no constitutional question there. So if that making sense to you?
Yep. I don't know. I'm all for it, as long as you get it done on the right end and it doesn't come back to haunt us, because it's coming back to haunt us.
Right.
We don't know what easements we have. We don't have paid for restoration plans that we can count on and make the habitat the right habitat.
Yep.
And we certainly don't want to take advantage of the taxpayers in the counties where there's public land been established, and then have to worry about it later on how we're going to pay for it. So.
I think before you got here, Representative Dill, we asked that, we're looking up at the corner here on page 11, where it's talking about WMAs and how much land they have acquired and plan to acquire, that we wanted to know how much of that land, and it apparently is not very much, is in high-quality restoration right now. And so we are looking to see how much needs to be done, and we can maybe figure out the cost from there. Is that helpful to you? Did I get it? Okay. I think we're on the same page here, so I always like it when we're on the same page. You want to continue?
Madam Chair, members, yes. Just while we're under this section and we talk about wildlife habitat, I want to just spend a few seconds on aquatic habitat. The aquatic management areas, you'll see the second box there. Currently, we have 620 miles of cold water, 220 miles of warm water, AMAs, or aquatic management areas. The long-term goal, again, from the Citizens Advisory Group, was 2,120 miles of cold water and 1,320 miles of warm water. We have not been meeting this goal. This program is not as popular or hasn't been funded as successfully as the Wildlife Management Area program has through the capital bonding process, Madam Chair. But it is one that does provide multiple benefits of habitat, water quality, and access. So it's just something, as we talk about habitat and acquisition, we often talk about, we spend a lot of time talking about wildlife management areas. We don't spend a lot of time talking about aquatic management areas, but we need to spend more time talking about both. So we do appreciate your comments on the WMAs, and we'll pull together the same information on AMAs as well, Madam Chair.
Are the Heritage Council folks aware of this need that has been targeted?
Madam Chair, regarding the restoration?
No, regarding the cold and warm water mileage.
Madam Chair, yes, they are. I provided a series of presentations for the council on existing plans and programs, and one of those that I highlighted was the Aquatic Management Area Plan last month.
Madam Chair, if you'd like, we could provide a link. We have all of these citizen plans up on our website. I'd like to send that to you, and you could send it out to the committee members so they can, rather than make copies of all these plans,
you don't want copies.
They can just have all of those links, so we'll do that forthwith. I'd like to move on to strategic objective number three. This objective talks about technical assistance planning and public participation.
Just a second. Do you want to just mention about wild rice?
Sure. Thank you so much, Madam Chair. One of the things that we also work on, this is really more of a shallow lake program initiative, but wild rice is a very, very important cultural, spiritual, and economic factor within the state of Minnesota. Actually, this morning I was talking with the Indian Affairs Council about our wildlife natural rice, wild rice report. I have too many terms going through my head. And the importance it is of the food source for wildlife, the water quality that's out there, and you can see here our goals has been exceeded every year since 2004. In 2007, 237 basins out of 1,000 were actively managed, totaling 80,000 acres, and our goal is to actively manage the number of wild rice lakes requiring management exceeding 500. So we need to do a lot of work on that. A lot of times it focuses on drawdowns, making sure that those lakes are restored and that those wild rice beds are actively managed. If the water gets too high, the rice will not naturally reproduce. It's something that the report that actually Representative Moe was very, it was a bill that he had working through the House and Senate. It required us to do an extensive report. We prepared that last year. We never had an opportunity to present those findings, so I'm hoping that we can work with the policy committee to talk about that report. And we're having a meeting actually on Thursday talking about regulations regarding wild rice harvesting and also how do we improve the management of these activities. And it's something we anticipate coming back next session with a comprehensive package focusing on shallow lakes and wild rice management. Thank you. Going back to strategic objective number three, talking about the technical assistance plan and public participation. It's approximately $21 million of the Fish and Wildlife budget for 08-09, with $20 million or 94% of it coming from the Game and Fish Fund, $100,000 from the gift account, $700,000 from the general fund, $400,000 from the federal fund, and $100,000 from the special revenue fund. This area focuses on providing technical assistance, such as a private land assistance to landowners of all types, some environmental review work, which we're going to focus, have a more in-depth discussion of environmental review activities under the Ecological Resources Division, public information, permitting and planning and coordination. You can see if you go to the table, Madam Chair, members, this is under number three. Some of the goals we have are acres and conservation land retirement under state and federal farmland programs. Our goal that we haven't met was to have more than 2 million acres enrolled in conservation programs by the end of the 2002 Farm Bill. Currently, we have 1.77 million acres enrolled as of 8/30/08. This is the focus of some of our working lands initiatives as well, is trying to work with landowners to have them keep their land into these conservation programs. You can see that talking about crop prices, as I think Representative Hamilton is very familiar with, the production prices of having that land in production versus the benefit of having it in conservation are far out of line right now. We need to try to figure out how we can work with landowners to get them to put land back in, or keep land more specifically in these programs. A lot of it's sitting around coffee tables and kitchen tables and working with the landowners and trying to figure out a plan of different opportunities that are out there, not only DNR, but Bowser, Federal Farm Bill, NRCS. It's presenting all of those opportunities to those landowners. It's a difficult challenge, but one that we're trying to figure out the best way to do, not only from the DNR, but how should government really provide these services? What kind of private landowner assisted opportunities should we be providing? And how are they done? Soil Water Conservation Districts, as I mentioned, Bowser, Ag, DNR. We're working actively trying to figure out the best way to provide that conservation assistance, and I'm hoping that sooner rather than later we can come up with some good ideas for you guys to think about. So,
one of the things that you did give me a sheet, and I haven't sent it out to the committee because it's not complete, about working lands and what you paid per acre, but I didn't see anything about what outcomes, what you got for the dollar you paid, what kind of restoration you're requiring. What is it that Minnesota citizens got for that dollar? So if you could finish that up, and I'd be glad to get it around to members.
Madam Chair, we still are working on that, and it's just pulling a lot of different information from a lot of different sources together, so we'll get that to you as soon as we possibly can.
It seems to me, following up on what Representative Dill said, that should be part of the routine management of these kinds of lands, because they shouldn't have to be all pulled together. Should be just part of our system approach. Is that getting at part of what you're saying, Representative Dill? Okay. Go on.
Thank you. Talking under this objective, still talking about acres of prairie and wetlands, grasslands protected. Our goal here was to increase the number of high-quality prairie wetland complexes through restoration and protection for a total of 40,000 grassland acres by all partners each year. We did reach this goal in 06 and 07, but by the end there was a loss of 42,000 acres in 08 just due to prices. Scheduled timing of when these easements were to come out of the program. So the offsets to these losses included 9,000 acres of WMA and another 9,000 acres of Fish and Wildlife, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service lands. This is part of our duck recovery plan, Madam Chair, and it's an issue I think you'll be discussing not only with us through our budget process, but also with the Board of Soil and Water Resources as well, because they are a very active player in trying to keep these easements in place. And it's a challenge, as I just talked about. So it's something that the whole state, the whole region is struggling with.
This is because these were temporary easements, not permanent easements. Am I getting that correct?
Not sure that's correct. These mostly loss of conservation reserve program acres, which are 10 to 15 years. And this, I might add, this 40,000 per year goal ties back to our duck recovery plan that we developed. We had a goal of increasing the amount of wetland and grassland on both public and private land by 2 million acres over 50 years. And so that's the origin of that 40,000 acre per year target that we set. And I think the fact that we were successful in 2006 and 2007, but fell short in 2008 as a result of some of these changes related to the farm bill, demonstrates the importance of working with private landowners and really changing the development.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Mr. Meyer, and Director Shad. One of the pieces that was in the farm bill that was passed last year was the sod saver, or the prairie native prairie protection program, and I believe that the federal government did have a short time window for rules that were either in or about to end. And relating to that issue of temporary easements and trying to protect native prairie from being plowed up, I think your agency had said, or one of the entities had said, about 60,000 acres of native prairie that was left in the state. And it's the governor's responsibility to opt in. Could you maybe just say what the status is of that, if the agencies that are involved have agreed on the need to opt in, and if they haven't, what's happening?
Madam Chair, Representative Hanson, there's a deadline of February 15th that USDA has asked that governors, they're not required to meet that deadline, but they've asked if they could notify whether they're willing to opt in or not into this program. And this applies to just the prairie poplar states, so it would be Minnesota, Iowa, North and South Dakota, Montana, I believe, are the states involved. We've been in active discussions with Bowser, State Department of Agriculture, and the Governor's Office on this. Still researching a few questions about exactly what this might mean to some of our producers if the governor were to opt in, and fully intend to make that decision by the 15th.
Are there other states that have already opted in?
Madam Chair, to my knowledge, no state has declared one way or the other.
One of the major factors, Madam Chair, is we're just trying to get a better idea of what those draft rules will actually say. We haven't had a clear understanding of what these rules will be, and until we have that, it'd be like signing a contract before the papers without any terms on there. So we fully understand the benefits of the program, but we just need a little bit more information before we can commit to it. So with any luck, we will have that decision made shortly, Madam Chair.
Let us know.
I think Representative Hanson, you guys will might get a letter before I do, but I don't know. Talking about some of other accomplishments or objectives under this area, the ongoing citizen outreach activities, some of the activities that are covered here that you may have heard of recently, one is our moose and angling advisory committees. A lot of our roundtable activities are focused under here. The musky long range plan, roadside for wildlife, watershed assistance, UMOR, WMA, management plan, and public use. All of our activities regarding those management type plans that are out there are focused under this objective. If there's no questions, I'll move on to number four. Similar but a little bit different, talking about outreach and department programs. This is one of our gateway areas that we're looking for recruitment and retention issues under. Increased multicultural, urban, and youth recreation participation and appreciation of Minnesota's outdoor heritage. $4.6 million was budgeted for these activities for the fall or the past biennium, with $1.3 million from the general fund, 1% from the Natural Resources Fund, $100,000 from the federal fund, a small part from the Special Revenue Fund, again 1%, and the bulk of it, or 67%, coming from the Game and Fish Fund. These are all of our outreach education programs. MinAqua is a great example. Hunter Recruitment and Retention, our Archery in the Schools program would fall under this area. Angling and Hunting Mentoring. The Southeast Asian program, Becoming an Outdoors Woman. Market Research, Education Workshops. Some of the outcomes, if you go to the spreadsheet, talk about what our target was to deliver 25,000 hours of education contact time. Actual program hours were less than that, but the participant number exceeded the target by 54%. You can see there. I'm not going to go into great detail. This is an area of great importance to the department, and one that we need to continue to do and increase. If you look at our youth mentor hunting opportunities that we had, and we can provide an update to you on some of those things. It's been a successful year, and that the Archery in the Schools program is just the correlation between that and young hunters getting out in the woods and actually participating in archery hunting is phenomenal. And actually some of the programs in the metro area actually take their students and make them earn a hunt by doing buckthorn removal and doing those types of activities. So it is another way for them to learn about forestry, invasive species, conservation education, while they're participating in outdoor activities. Are there any questions about this objective?
I don't see any. Go ahead.
Thank you very much. Objective number five, public information and customer service. $17.7 million for last year's biennial, for this current biennial budget, I should say. 65% of that coming from the Game and Fish Fund. Small percentages from the Gift Account General Fund. $5.6 million from the Natural Resources Fund. $300,000 federal funding and $100,000 from the Special Revenue Fund. Some of the supporting programs are recreation of vehicle, game and fish permitting and licensing. All of our ELS operations are out of here. And for those of you who were able to see at the tour that the policy committee had over there, see our next generation of ELS systems. It's kind of exciting how it's going to be a lot easier. It will prevent people from buying licenses that somehow it seems like they always... I had a legislator contact me a couple of days ago. He thought he bought two fishing licenses for the same year. And there's just those operator errors that are in with any system, but our new system will be a lot more user-friendly and touchscreen driven, and we're hoping to come up with some ideas or activities that capturing some information so we can creatively or actively market with people. Thinking, or we were talking about over in the Senate, how can we capture people's email addresses to do active marketing that way? It's something that we need to explore the opportunities, but also how do you deal with the problems of bounce back addresses and things like that. But we're trying to be as innovative as possible and trying to catch and reach as many people as out there as we can. Lastly, Madam Chair, it's not on this slide, but I don't have a slide on it, but it's on under this section. It's the treaty payments that we do pay. There's approximately $15 million of treaty payments that are ongoing through the tribes, through various agreements that are represented under this section as well. And just, we talked about some of our outcomes. I'm just going to go through these briefly. We're going to spend more time as we talk through 10 and 11 budget. We didn't meet the acres of protected or acres protected wildlife management areas. We're close, but again, funding is the main problem there. And this is just a summary. Talking about some of the things that are in the conservation agenda, trout, wild turkey permits, acres of habitat protected, acres and conservation easements, and then the recruitment piece that we need to continue to actively work on, Madam Chair. There's no questions. Actually, we're going to go to enforcement next because it does have a tie into the Fish and Wildlife Division, so we're going to need to move through on the spreadsheet to page
17.
13? 13. Oh, you guys are working off that one. I'm sorry. So you have the corrected version. I have the old one. With me tonight, I have Captain Jim Conrad from the Enforcement Division to help us answer some questions. The strategic objectives here under the Division of Enforcement are to protect natural resources and public safety through quality education and law enforcement, environmental protection, fisheries and game protection, water recreation, public safety and service, and recreational enforcement, safety, training, and education. We have over 277,000 registered snowmobiles, 260,000 registered recreational vehicles, and for the past biennium, over 40,000 students have attended DNR safety training classes. Or past, that was just an 08 number, I believe, Madam Chair. The budget by strategic objectives for the Division of Enforcement is approximately $66 million. Of that, 60% focuses on fisheries and game protection, $9.2 million on water recreation, $1.3 public safety and service, enforcement and safety training, $10.5 million in environmental protection, $5.2 million. Moving on to the first strategic objective, talking about environmental protection. The goal here is to protect...
Hang on before you go ahead. Right. Representative Anvil.
Just one question before I forget it. is there some kind of a pass-through mechanism from the department to county law enforcement for water safety enforcement and ATV and snowmobile enforcement? And how does that mechanism work? And does that require a local match?
Madam Chair, Representative for the record, Jim Conrad. acting administrative manager for the Division of Enforcement. Yes, there is a process through the Natural Resource Fund and the Water Recreation Fund where the counties and some local agencies as well get passed through grants. The determination, they make application. I don't believe that there are matching grants federally, but the Water Rec is actually not handled through our division, but rather handled through Information and Education, which would be Kim Eldrum's program.
Seems as though both of these are direct enforcement functions. So I wonder about Mr. Eldrum's water involvement on that end, because this seems real direct enforcement. And when I was asking about a match, I was wondering if the counties are required to match any state pass-through monies that they get.
Madam Chair, Representative, my understanding is that they have programs. They are given specific duties such as rescue, body recovery, that sort of thing. So they are out there doing those duties, and those are not part of the conservation officer duties. They were separated out many, many years ago.
Okay.
And the pass-through money that we give to them is for enforcement purposes only, to intensify enforcement.
Madam Chair, just a final comment on this. I'm just looking for areas of overlap, areas where we can get some efficiencies, and areas where clearer lines of following the dollars are more appropriate. And that's the only reason why I've asked.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Moving on to objective number one under environmental protection, you can see that the budgeted numbers under this section are $5.2 million, $5 million from the general fund, and $200,000 from the remediation fund. Actually, that's from the environmental fund. It comes from solid waste management tax dollars, I believe, Madam Chair. Do we do it for on-site burning and things of those types of activities? The supporting programs under this piece focus on Wetland Conservation Act. This is where the Operation Bird's Eye View their activities come out of, water quality enforcement and other environmental protection. And if you go to the spreadsheet, we've done the best to provide context in two different ways. You can see on the very right column, one is talking about hours of enforcement, and then the second piece is talking about citations and warnings. The main objective of the enforcement division is not always to act as an officer issuing tickets. There is a huge component of education and training that's involved as well. The Wetland Conservation Act issues are a little bit more unique, but when we're out in the field or when our officers are out in the field, the first and foremost opportunity is a learning opportunity, not to immediately give them a ticket for something if at all possible. Again, that matters. It's a different situation to situation and circumstances to circumstances, but it's our hope that our officers are out there trying to forge the goodwill of the state and the department wherever possible and provide learning opportunities rather than give somebody a ticket. But there's always those issues that don't fall in line with that where we do need to give a ticket. And if a warning ticket is authorized, they do go back to their homes, which are their offices, and check their records, and will follow up. If that person had received a warning ticket previously, they will then follow up with a citation. So there is a system in place to keep track of the situations at hand, I should say.
Representative Portman.
Thank you. I just have a question about enforcement. If there's somebody who has low-lying property that looks like a wetland and they take a big, huge pile of dirt and put it next to that area and they leave it there over a number of years and it rains and slowly the wetland is no longer a wetland, is that within your area of things that you watch for and enforce against? Because it seems like it's a pretty common practice.
Madam Chair, Representative, yeah, that would fall under some of our enforcement authority. sometimes some of these violations are very subtle, which would be that situation. There are regulations that provide that if you are storing silt like that next to a susceptible wetland, that a silt fence be put up to prevent that sort of thing. Also at construction sites, those sort of things to prevent that exact thing from happening. Difficult thing to monitor, however.
Right, I'm wondering if there's any situations where you have gone in and talked to a landowner about that, how you catch it.
Madam Chair, Representative, in most cases it's a neighbor or a passerby or somebody that sees that situation and brings it to our attention, to our officer's attention, and they will go out and investigate that
individual. Because if they don't get caught and then they want to build something, and they go to get a permit, it's possible that they can completely evade the Wetlands Conservation Act by having let the erosion happen over time.
Madam Chair, Representative, yes, that's correct. Some of them do slip through our fingers. We do our best not to let that happen, of course.
Just a final, what's the interplay between your responsibility there and then the local jurisdictions, like the soil and water conservation districts and the watershed authorities?
Madam Chair, Representative, there is an interaction between all of those agencies that you have mentioned. Any one of them can bring it to the attention of a conservation officer who can issue a cease and desist and make sure that begins the process of either restoration or ceases the damage that's being done at that point until further investigation can be done.
Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Commissioner Meyer, you just got my interest. Don't the COs, I know they have laptops in the pickups, do their BlackBerries have access to the ELS system, or do they carry BlackBerry?
Madam Chair, Representative McNamara, does the BlackBerry work in your office, Representative Hill?
I mean,
Madam Chair, I was thinking instead of BlackBerries, I thought they carried Blackjacks.
It's a good, great question, though. One of the issues that we have is service provided throughout the state, and the ELS system is, we don't have wireless cards. Some of our offices have wireless cards. They all have internet access at their home, but when you're out in the field, there's a lot of areas that don't have coverage. So we're constantly trying to figure out the best way to do this, and our new system will provide us with some new opportunities to download the current information. You see small laptops that are out there, handheld computers. I think they're even coming out on the market now where a person could take your driver's license and swipe it through and you could activate the system that way. But if the technology doesn't apply equally throughout the state.
BlackBerries aren't native to Minnesota.
I think they are, Madam Chair.
No, they're not.
They're not, okay.
That's a problem.
I actually don't think that the commissioner, deputy commissioner, ever answered my question. Did you? Do they, I know they have, I mean, I'll take issue a little bit. If they got Verizon, they have service pretty good. I have it in my deer stand, Representative Dill, in the middle of nowhere. But do they not there have a BlackBerry?
That was curious, Representative. I can speak to that from experience. I have only been out of the field for about 2.5 years now, and I did have an air card, and I worked Waterfall Task Force, which took me all over the state, and there are a lot of dead zones out there. We did have a Verizon air card. Or, I'm sorry, it's Sprint. And that was state contract. And sometimes it worked, sometimes it didn't. We tried our best. And there are only about, 40 officers that have that service available to them at this time. We did put in an initiative a couple years ago to try to go statewide. So.
Madam Chair?
Yes, Representative Jill.
Can you hear me now?
I was a little slow. Sorry, I thought I figured it out. Only a landscaper. Come on, give me a break.
You had said that the outcome here is to forge goodwill for Minnesota.
Let me push back a little bit on that. I had assumed that the outcome for the conservation officers was to protect our natural resources, and so to the extent that folks chose not to damage our natural resources, then your outcomes are good. But to the extent they choose to damage our natural resources, your outcomes aren't good. So how do you measure that outcome?
Madam Chair, you're absolutely right. Our outcome should be the protection of the natural resource, and if we are doing our job, if we are visible, if we are out there making those contacts, that sort of thing, our hope is that by our presence that they do not do damage to the resources or do not exceed their harvest or whatever. However, people being as they are, doesn't work that way. So really, I mean, for us to measure our ability to impact their damage to the environment would be more visibility, more time spent out in the field, so that every person who thought about taking an extra fish or killing an illegal deer or whatever would have one of us looking over their shoulder. Obviously, we can't do that. We do the best that we can. We have seen, and this is maybe just a glitch, but between last year and this year, we saw a drop in citations and warnings. I don't know if that is a result of the fact that we have been provided with more conservation officers over the past few years than we had maybe 10 years ago, but we like to hope that that's the reason. It's an inexact science that is very difficult to measure.
It is inexact. I spend some time outdoors in the summertime, and I never see a conservation officer. I still obey the law. But so the question is for those who don't see a conservation officer, because you're not, we'll never have enough of them. How to...
Madam Chair.
What's that?
Just for the committee's information. I've been in the woods for going on 63 years. I have never seen more checks, more visible, polite surveillance in the woods as I have in the last 5 years. And I've witnessed less illegal activity, and less game violations of all kinds, hunting and fishing, than ever before. Something is working. I think it's visibility, but I also think it's the culture is changing finally. Education is working. Youngsters in school. All of this is having an impact where I live.
Well, I was just sitting here thinking, maybe conservation officers like where you live better than where I am. And that's the message I draw from that.
You're welcome. Come and try it out.
That's right. We just need to keep a closer eye on him than you.
If you would continue, please.
Thank you very much. Just in my comments talking about tickets and warnings, just I wanted to give a little context that we have both of those numbers in there. So that's where my comments are focused on. You need to also remember that these are just 08 numbers, especially when we talk about the bird's eye view flight, 130 hours provided in last year with our goal of 2,400 hours committed to the operation. Talking about water quality enforcement, the goal of 5,000 hours, we provided 6,500 hours. That's 127 cease and desist orders issues for public waters and aquatic plant removal issues. And 294 citations with 101 warnings issued for water quality related issues. Also, we provided 6,500 hours of enforcement on wildlife management areas, timber, solid waste, air quality, and fires, with 553 citations and 581 warnings issued. Moving on to objective number two, focusing on fisheries and game protection. This is really what people think a game warden or a conservation officer does with their time, I think, but they do a lot of other stuff. This objective focuses on the protective fishery stocks, small game, migratory waterfowl, big game populations, through law enforcement and education efforts. Funding was approximately $40 million, Madam Chair, with 100% of that basically coming from the Game and Fish Fund. Supporting programs include fisheries enforcement, game enforcement, and also our firearm safety training and advanced hunter education program. I'm not going to go into extreme detail on the outcomes because we did meet all of our goals, but just on a side note, we've trained over 1 million students in firearm safety programs, 1,072,000 to be exact, since 1955, which is a huge success for us. 2008, we trained 23,000 students in firearms safely, and I think it does show in our safety statistics out in the field as well, Madam Chair.
Representative Hanson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And speaking with some of your conservation officers, they indicated with a worsening economy that there's an increase, or they are seeing or hearing of an increase in poaching, with taking a game during the off season. And just wondering if that's correct, or if that's a regional or a site specific situation.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's kind of an anecdotal thing. It's hard to measure because a lot of violations go undetected. We would believe that if we catch more people that there must be more of it happening, but I don't know how to address that statistically to indicate that. But yes, when times are tough, people are maybe more apt to keep a few extra fish or take a chance to shoot that deer the day after season that they didn't fill their tag during the season. That's historically that happened back in the 30s and tougher times. So I would guess that maybe we will see an increase in that sort of activity.
Representative Hanson, the complaint I get the most, and practically the only complaint I get about conservation officers, is about aquatic management and people getting stuff on their boats and getting into a lake. And we can see by our outcome how many more lakes are infected. And that number, I think we need to, as a committee, visit that number because it does seem high to me. And as maybe Ecological Services comes up here, they can tell us how many more lakes will get milfoil, how many more lakes will get curly lake pondweed. And if there is anything that, there's nothing more visible to citizens than that. They know it by seeing somebody do it, or because there's another lake on the list. So, and that's expensive for us, maybe more than poaching a deer even, but it's expensive for all Minnesotans when another lake gets an invasive species. I don't know if you all hear the same thing that I'm hearing. No. Okay, well, no lakes up in your area are contaminated. Okay, if you would continue.
Sure, thank you. Strategic objective number three talks about water recreation. This is the boat and water safety activities, public access to water, enforcement education, including the grants to local law enforcement. We will provide information to the committee on all of our grant activities with the local law enforcement. They do focus on boat and water, snowmobile, OHV, ATV, and there are specific contractual arrangements that we have set up with those local units of government. You can see the funding here is 65% from the Natural Resources Fund, and actually this is from the water recreation account, the registration fees that people pay on their boats, and federal funding of $3.2 million. The supporting programs are boat and water safety enforcement, public access enforcement management, and grants to local law enforcement. And Madam Chair, a huge success you may have seen in the paper recently is our lowest boating fatality, I believe, ever, Captain Conrad?
Yes, that's correct. The lowest ever.
So, and there's a lot of people out on the lakes, especially the Metro Lakes, because they aren't going far away sometimes. So we see people will travel a little farther, maybe once or twice rather than every weekend, but the the traffic on the Metro Lake has been increasing, and to have that kind of statistic is really a shot in the arm for the work that our officers and the local law enforcement officers are doing. Moving on to strategic objective 4, talking about public safety and service, this is the area where we support police and sheriff's law enforcement efforts for activities such as disaster response, nuisance wildlife, nuisance wild animals. Not a lot of money budget here, $1.3 million for the biennium, with $500,000 from the general fund, $800,000 from the natural resources fund, and a small portion of federal funding. This is our mutual aid type activities where we are assisting the local, providing assistance to other local law enforcement agencies, including search and rescue, and also dealing with nuisance wild animal responses and control. When something happens of a catastrophic nature, the I-35 bridge, we had boats in the water immediately, within 5 minutes probably of that happening, to provide search and rescue opportunities. The flood in southeastern Minnesota, our officers were on the spot. They saved several lives through their work with their airboats and their expertise in search and rescue and first aid and safety training. And they're always there. When something happens, we are there no matter what. And this is something like, as we talk about, fire is a number one priority. Well, safety is a number one priority as well. And these are the folks and these activities under this objective are there making sure that when something happens, there's somebody there to help. So talking about a little bit under this, we just provided 5,800 hours of assistance to local other law enforcement agencies. This was a little bit high because of some of the disasters, the Hugo tornado, the bridge, as I spoke of, and the flooding events. So it's usually not this high. We hope it's not this high, but again, when these types of activities happen, they go to the top of the list. They're the first and foremost activities that becomes important to the division. Moving on to number 5, we're talking about recreation enforcement safety training. $10.5 million here. These are our safety training and law enforcement services for ATVs, off-highway motorcycles, off-road vehicles, and snowmobiles. All of these, most 83% of the activities are funded from those accounts and those users of these activities, people who are providing the state with money for the resources that they're looking for. $1.8 million from the general fund and a small piece from the special revenue fund. A big piece of this is the safety training and education program. I believe it is 1976 or older. You have to, if you're born after 1976, you have to have a snowmobile safety training certificate. If you're born after 1979, you have to have firearm safety. ATVs is 79 or 81, I believe. They're all different ages, but most nowadays, anybody over the age of, to legally ride, if you're over the age of 16, you have to go through a safety training program. We do take those activities, and it's the citizens of the state, members of the clubs, who are providing the training most for the most part. Parks, forestry, and other non-motorized enforcement activities also here, and the grants again to local law enforcement. You can see the goals that we have of 15,500 hours of ATV, 10,000 hours of snowmobile, 1,000 hours of off-highway motorcycle, and 1,000 hours of off-road vehicle enforcement. We did meet those goals, and our fatalities, I think, are lower than they have been for a long time, Madam Chair. I think there's a question.
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner, could you talk a little bit about the role of volunteers in these processes, whether it's firearms training or other safety training activities that the department takes part in? I know that volunteers are a big part of that in my part of the world, and I think we should give them some credit in this discussion.
Madam Chair, and that was exactly, members, that was exactly the basis of my comment. The instructors, and I don't have the specific numbers off the top of my head, but our firearm safety program is all volunteer-based. Our ATV instructor program, our snowmobile safety program, all of these, our officers, our regional training officers, provide the training and the implementation, the tools they need, but then they schedule the classes, they take time out of their nights, their days, they take time out of their weekends to provide this training. And, you know, we had snowmobile training classes going on this year in January, which is rather unusual because of the demand, because of the snow. There's firearm safety classes going on right now. I'm a certified firearm safety instructor, a bow education instructor, and I do a lot of independent exam work with people so they can get out in the field. They'll call me up and we'll go through the tests and the requirements and take them out and do some shooting, make sure that they are safe. But it's that network of volunteer instructors that really makes this activity the very successful ones that they are.
Madam Chair, Deputy Commissioner, I'd like to point out that I'm a graduate of the firearm safety training course, and I would guess in about 1966 or so, and unlike the former Vice President, I haven't shot anybody yet.
We're glad to hear that.
Madam Chair, maybe you can help us teach the class here.
Just a quick question about ATV training. If I remember right, there was, when I was last on this committee, which was 05-06, I thought there was a disconnect between the age that training was provided and the age when we wanted to let ATV riders out, because I think I had a kid that fell in the, what I thought is the gap. Like, he wasn't old enough to get trained, but he was old enough to go riding.
Madam Chair, Representative, I'm not quite up to date on that, but we have had, every year since you were last on the committee, we have had modifications to try to take care of those discrepancies. I'm not sure if it's the one that that's particularly applied to you was resolved, but I would think so.
What's the youngest age that you provide ATV training for?
I believe that's 12. Madam Chair, Representative, I believe it's 12 years old.
Representative,
Madam Chair, take the training before you're 12, as long as you're, when you do turn 12, then you can ride. So you can take it at 11, but then once you turn 12, then you can ride with that certification.
That's the youngest you can ride alone.
That's the youngest you can ride alone. You can ride with other adults, you know, younger than that, on smaller machines if the machine fits you.
Or you can ride on private land before
right.
then,
absolutely.
Right? So that was the thing that my son was riding on grandpa's land, but I wanted him to take the training, right? Okay.
He takes training at 11.
I think we're about finished up here. Is that right?
Sure, yes.
Okay, one question. The legislative auditor, one of the things the legislative auditor pointed out to us was that in tracking hours of what people were doing, the auditor could not figure out how hours were being spent. I mean, just the way they were tracked. And how is that going now?
Madam Chair, we build our work plans based on funding. We look at, say, game and fish funding, and then we decide how much it costs to give an hour of service. And then divide that into the total and then figure out how many officers we have and how many hours they can provide. You know, they're limited, obviously. And at that point, that's how we make our work plans. We track those through a computer system called DEERS. It's a daily report type of program. And we load that work plan into the program so an officer, as he's working throughout the year, can make checks on that and see where he is as far as the number of hours provided for ATV, the number of hours provided for fish and game, that sort of thing. And then we also have the supervisors available to check into that and redirect the officer's activities based on those work plans so that we are true to the fund in the hours of work that we provide. I think that we're pretty good at that. Some of the little glitches that we are unable to, and maybe this is what the auditor's report alluded to, there within Game and Fish, there are little specialty things like old Red Lake, and we have activity codes for that individual lake. If you work on there, not only is it a game and fish hour, but it is specifically a Red Lake hour. we try to build that into the greatest detail that we can. We maybe didn't do as good a job as we should have in some of those. And
the specific issue was when the legislative auditor was looking at how many hours were spent on the convention, couldn't figure it out because some hours were put into a general kind of management category and the auditor didn't know what was that hour was used for. Was that hour used for a convention or was it used for something else? And that, I think, have I got that right, Representative Hansen? Then that's the question. Has that problem been solved?
Okay, Madam Chair, yes, it has. I'm guessing that we won't ever have another one of those conventions, and I'm hoping we don't. The problem was that there was not a code in that system that I just described set up specifically for that. There was no direction provided to the officers as to how to code those hours. So a lot of officers were coding them on however that they felt it was appropriate. As the auditor said, a lot of those weren't appropriately coded. And that was an oversight by management. And I would like to guarantee I'm only going to be around for 2.5 years. I hope in my next 2.5 years... my next 2.5 years that we do not have that issue come up again and we will not disappoint you in that manner.
Well, that's good to hear and we'll hope that's right. Representative Dill.
I have a question, Captain, about if so a conservation officer is out doing one thing, doing boat safety, and he sees someone poach a deer. Now, does he change, you know, I've been asked this question, and I certainly can't answer it. So he sees someone poach a deer. Now, does he pull out his work plan on his BlackBerry? It doesn't work. And then fill in, change his work schedule then and charge another account because he now is doing a poaching violation? Or how does that all work? I mean, I always wonder about that. If they're going down the highway and they see a snowmobile, don't stop. They don't stop at a stop sign. So now he pursues that person. How does that all work?
Madam Chair, Representative, I'll give you a little experience from myself. Many times I was on Lake Minnetonka doing boat and water work, okay, and saw a two-liner, somebody using an extra line.
Sad subject.
But it's an easy one to understand. I can count to two pretty good. But anyway, in that situation, maybe I had planned on my day being boat and water, and I would have planned 8 or 10 or whatever hours I spent out there as boat and water. Well, that 1 hour that I spent dealing with this guy, and it might not be a whole hour, it might be half an hour or whatever, we could break it down to a quarter hour on that program if we wanted to. Whatever time I spent doing that would be coded to that. And specifically, we start out the day, conservation officers start out the day without, you know, always with a plan. I'm going to work duck hunters or I'm going to work whatever. But we certainly cannot control what happens during that day, and we are ready to adjust our activity accordingly.
Thank you. I think we're going to have to move on. I appreciate your testimony. And
thank you, Madam Chair.
Glad for your plan of tracking for hours. Are we ready for ecological?
We're going to move into ecological resources now, and Director Hirsch will come down. Representative Bill, if you do that two-line license, they'll spend more time checking those two-line issues. So, Madam Chair, the Division of Ecological Resources has several strategic objectives: non-game and rare resources, working with the lakes and rivers, ecosystem health, and integrated conservation information. Just at the sidebar here, nearly 2 million Minnesotans actively watch, feed, or photograph wildlife. 54% participation rate, and Minnesota ranks number 2 in the nation in those activities. As we look at the budget for the division, 5 strategic objectives, the budget, Madam Chair and members, is approximately $50.7 million. Of this, non-game and rare resources activities is about 35%. Lakes and rivers about 17%, ecosystem health 28%, and integrated conservation information approximately 20%. just a critical trend that we've talked about are the increasing demands for environmental review. And Madam Chair, I know you did want to talk a little bit about environmental review and how it's done. So I'd like to just spend a few minutes talking about environmental review, and I think people are trying to figure out what page we're on.
Yes, we are switching here for spreadsheet. Does everybody have a spreadsheet? Because I don't.
What I'm looking at, it's a new one with the graphic on the front. It says draft V3, dated 2309. Got this on the front of it.
No, mine's way earlier.
Recycle all the other ones you have, because this one's up the most up-to-date version. Please. And on this, we're on page 13.
Continue.
All right, are we ready again? Mm-hmm. I apologize for the confusion. Madam Chair, as I was saying, the Division of Ecological Resources does coordinate all of our environmental review activities, and the way I kind of talk about it is capital E environmental review, where we are the responsible government unit and those project proposals are paying for those costs. And then there's small E environmental review, if you want to think of it that way, where we're participating or doing review on behalf of a RGU or a project or an EAW perhaps. And actually, I'd like to just have Director Hirsch go through these critical trends and help give the committee a better understanding of our environmental review activities that we have and that we have ongoing. Does everybody have the PowerPoint presentation? All right.
Madam Chair, Member Steve Hirsch, DNR Ecological Resources Acting Director. And what I thought I'd maybe do first is just talk about the sort of the different categories of environmental review we do, just so folks could have an understanding as we talk into more of the details. But we have formal responsibilities under the Minnesota Environmental Protection Act, or NEPA, that we have to carry out. And this is, as Commissioner Meyer stated, typically when we are the RGU or responsible government unit to do either an environmental assessment worksheet or an environmental impact statement. There are, you know, what are referred to as mandatory EAW categories. And when DNR is the RGU, then we are required by law to do the EAW or environmental assessment worksheet. Some of these projects, in fact, many of them, we are actually the project proposer as well. And these would be things like when we do stream modification, stream restoration projects, wildlife impoundments, trail projects, we're actually the RGU and also the project proposer. Then there are other projects where we are the RGU responsible to do the EAW, but a private entity is the project proposer. And good examples of these would be metallic mineral mining or peatland mining. So those are examples of where we're the RGU, and either we're the project proposer or the private entity is the project proposer. And for those projects, the project proposer bears the cost of submitting the data portion of the environmental assessment worksheet, but then the department or whoever is the RGU bears the cost of actually doing the environmental assessment worksheet. Then we have the longer environmental impact statement, or EIS, projects. And where the big ticket item here the last few years, of course, has been the mining projects. And the DNR is the RGU for metallic mineral mining projects. We currently have three of those going on right now. We completed one last year. And for EISs, the project proposer actually pays the cost of doing the EIS, so the department doesn't bear that cost. So that's, I think, when Mr. Meyer was, or Commissioner Meyer was referring to the big E, that's what would be the big E, or our formal responsibilities under NEPA. Then we have other environmental review activities where other entities are the RGU, and we're reviewing documents to help comment on those documents, to help the project proposer or the RGU identify the potential for significant environmental effects and then recommend ways to avoid those environmental effects. And a lot of the projects that we've been involved with in recent years fall under the energy category. Of course, we've got a lot of pipeline projects now, transmission lines, power plants, wind energy, ethanol, and so on. And those are our high priority areas where we are the
we're not the formal RGU, but we're still spending a lot of time reviewing documents and trying to make sure that these projects have a minimal impact on our resources. And then there are, and those are what I would say are our higher priority areas where we're not the RGU. And then we have, you know, our moderate priority areas, and these are things like where the federal government will do an environmental assessment or an EIS, or where there's a state environmental review from other RGUs, other local units of government, or other state agencies like DCA. So that kind of gives you a sort of a summary of what, you know, of what we do. I think just to mention a couple other things we do sometimes have to make environmental review need determinations. In other words, help determine whether an EAW or an EIS is required. And then we get involved also in environmental review policy stuff. When their EQB is doing new rules, they'll often ask the DNR to help, you know, support the rulemaking process by providing input.
Could you, not now, but later, give us the number of EAWs you do and the range of hours? Do they take 12 hours, 150 hours? And so how many hours you spent on EAWs? And the big numbers. So my understanding is, and let me see if I understand this right, is for an EAW, you will pay the cost of doing it, except people need to put their own facts on the table.
Madam Chair, that's correct.
But if it's an EIS, then the proposer is responsible for everything.
Madam Chair, correct.
And so where the state is reimbursed for those expenses.
Yep.
All right. So it's the EAWs that we've had some questions about. So if you just put how many hours the agency spent on them, the cost per hour, and the range of hours it takes, or, and maybe a median of what it how long it takes to do it. Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question about MnDOT projects, and how often is your agency one of the agencies that participates in the EAW or the EIS? Is it always if there's a water impact, or?
Madam Chair and Representative Hortman, we typically do engage in MnDOT projects. We actually have an employee by the name of Peter Leek that works in the MnDOT office, but is paid for, I believe, with DOT funds, but is actually an employee that works with our environmental review unit. So we get involved in both, you know, EAWs, EISs when they come along, and also just permitting. But not necessarily on every project, but where we feel like we can make meaningful input and have an interest in commenting.
Just a quick follow-up. So does Peter do all of the MnDOT EAW, EISs, and permitting?
Madam Chair and Representative Hortman, he doesn't actually do all of that, but he's sort of our liaison. The Department of Transportation actually has an environmental services unit that's fairly large that handles the environmental review work for that department.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, moving on to strategic objective number one, focusing on non-game and rare resources. The goal of this activity is protect and manage Minnesota's biological diversity, non-game and wildlife, and native plant communities with an emphasis on rare and declining resources. You can see here the budgeted expenditures are approximately $18 million, with a huge variety of funds, and I'll talk about those in a second here, but 25% from the general fund, 13% from the natural resources fund, 16% federal funding, 1% special revenue fund, 13% from the game and fish fund, some money from the Environmental Trust Fund, $5.1 million, and then some from the RIM match account. All of the activities in the Division of Ecological Resources, for the most part, exist with a high diversity of funding sources, and there's a commingling of funds throughout each of the activities because they do provide multiple benefits. Each activity provides multiple benefits. So it's very difficult for us to say, okay, of the $4 million general fund, it went to, I'll just use the top line, for three regional plant ecologists. Their funding strings are kind of commingled because of the multiple benefits or activities that they are providing. So just kind of keep that in mind as we're going through the divisions or the outcomes here. I'm just going back to the spreadsheet again, Madam Chair. You can see the Natural Heritage Program supported about 18% of those expenditures, and we have met our goals that we've been targeting, looking at local number of local governments using natural heritage data. Our target was 140 cumulative number of LGUs, and we have reached that goal. We do have three regional planning colleges in four of the regions that are out there right now. One was a vacancy was given up through previous year budget reduction, so it's in Region 4, actually, I believe. So we do have ongoing work from Region 3 and 4 that the person picked up. We just picked up the workload activities there. You can see another one talking about the number of sites linking ecological restoration and supplying woody biomass. This is a very successful program that was funded with one-time dollars last year, or last by this previous biennium, dealing with removing of basically buckthorn within 75 miles of the energy, St. Paul District Energy System. And it's been a highly successful project that really was able to provide resources and benefits to get people out, local projects to go out and remove the buckthorn. One that's really close by, you can go see, is up in Mount Park Boulevard. Maybe when it warms up a little bit, you can go and have lunch up there or something. But you can see the buckthorn that they took out, and the follow-up work that's going on is really helping to restore that, what was an oak savanna area. So this is a unique opportunity that we had, and it was highly successful. Talking about SNAs, 27% of the funds in this area are allocated for that. Talking about the number of sites protected, our target was to establish five new SNAs in 08-09 with a total target of 157 in the system by 2012. Right now, we're hoping to be at 147 by the end of the biennium, and we designated two in 08 and one in 09, so we're well on our way of meeting those goals. Non-game wildlife, we talk about loon population levels as an index there, and the goal here is to sustain a population of 2 to 3 adult loons per 100 acres. And our test area is Aiken and Crow Wing areas, and we have been meeting those goals. The Aiken Crow Wing area is of interest because the lakes are on predominantly private land in a region of rapid growth. This is one of the areas that we are challenged with as a state as we talk about landscape changes, and it's important that we're able to sustain that population in those areas. Lastly is the County Biological Survey, which has had large support from the legislature. Our goal there is to complete 70 counties by 2008 and all surveys in throughout the state, 87 counties by 2018. We completed 6 more in 2008, bringing the total to 71 counties, and we want to get that work done as soon as possible. If there's no questions, I'll move on to objective number 2, Madam Chair. This objective focuses on lakes and rivers, talking about conserving the lakes and rivers and shoreline resources, with an emphasis on systems ecology and stream resources, aquatic plants, invertebrates, and non-game fish. Approximately $8.6 million for budget expenditures for the biennium, again with that same kind of blend. 30% general fund, 24% federal funding, 7% natural resources fund, 30% from the game and fish fund, a small portion, $200,000 from the environmental trust fund, and $100,000 from the gift account. Programs here focused on stream habitat protection, lake habitat protection, clean water legacy activities, aquatic plants, non-game fish, aquatic invertebrates, and Mississippi River management. And if the spreadsheet, Madam Chair, on top of page 14 talks about some of those goals that we're working on. The first one, aquatic plants, 12% of the expended budget is estimated here. We don't have a target set. The goal is to continue effective implementation of permit programs, aquatic pesticide application inspections conducted annually, and results provided to the Department of Ag. And Madam Chair, we're pleased to announce that Administrative Law Judge has approved our rule package for the changes to the ADM rules. We're awaiting final approval on those, that package. And with any luck, we will be implementing those rulemaking changes this coming season.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Commissioner Meyer. I'm
curious if you, and you're talking about it now, so I'm just wanting a little more information on how we determine which chemicals we use are safe and what processes they go through. And I have a constituent who's particularly, I've gotten at least 5 emails about 2,4-D, and so I'm just want a little more information. You could provide a little now, and if you could follow up with some about what kind of processes we use to determine, you know, the cost benefit of the plant management versus what chemicals we're putting out in our environment in pretty significant levels.
It would be good if you would provide this in writing and give us the sheet that tells us how many pounds of chemicals and where we are this year compared to former years, because they do have that sheet, and I think that would be a helpful starting place. Is that all right? We see the sheet first, and then we and look at the process. I've been concerned about some of these being endocrine disruptors, and we find out that we don't have little girly fish, and that's not where I think the state wants to go.
Better than we can do that. This is probably the most effective way to communicate that information to you. Just a couple more of the outcomes here and objectives. Stream habitat protection. 27% of the budgeted expenditures are estimated. We are meeting our goals there, talking about the design and implementation of 15 natural channels projects. You can see that we're doing that in addition to a bunch of other projects. Working on an additional 32 stream restoration projects as technical consultants. There's some context there. Number of individuals educated about river and stream systems. We are reaching our goals there and continuing to provide outreach to key audiences and increase the understanding of river systems. Mississippi River Management, talking about continuing monitoring water quality, aquatic plants, mussels, and fish communities in target reaches of the Mississippi. And the water quality data is the basis for performing the Lake Pepin TMDL, which you'll be hearing a lot more about in the coming weeks, I'm assuming, Madam Chair. And the last one there is lake habitat protection, conducting aquatic plant assessments on 17 lakes in Cass County. We completed 70 nearshore habitat surveys on 15 lakes in Cass County to describe aquatic plant communities and conduct surveys delineating where these plant communities should be. Priority bulrush, wild rice, and water lily stands. Also issued 291 aeration permits through these activities. Moving on to objective number 3, ecosystem health. Monitor, assess, and reduce the impact of threats to Minnesota's natural resources from harmful invasive species, contaminants, fish diseases, and hazardous material spills. Approximately $14 million was expended for these activities, 46% from the general fund, 32% from the natural resources fund, 9% from the federal fund, and then 7% came in sick, some money again from the Environmental Trust Fund, small amounts from the gift account, and $1.2 million from the remediation fund. Supporting programs include the invasive species program, fish contaminants, our pathology lab, and then the natural resources damages assessment. If you go to the spreadsheet, Madam Chair, You can see that the bulk of these dollars are spent, 83% on invasive species activities. Looking at some of the outcomes or the context that we have is prevent the spread of zebra mussels to waters not connected to previous infestations. Now, our sampling data indicates the mussels are rapidly spreading downstream from their location that was identified in 2005 in Rice Lake, north of Brainerd, confirmed some sites below the dam in Little Falls. Tracking where these invasive species are and making sure that people are aware of the impacts and draining their live wells and not transporting water and abiding by the laws that we have are some of the key activities here. On your comment, Madam Chair, talking about the additional water bodies where Eurasian milk whale was found, our target is to limit the spread of those to no more than 10 new water bodies every year, and we do fully agree that it's not a good target to have, but it is a target that we are evaluating and measuring for. And last, in 2007, actually there was 11 new water bodies found. We've initiated some new grant programs. In FY08, a total of $50,000 is awarded, and $100,000 will be awarded in 09. due to some increase in funding that the legislature provided for those activities for management of critter reef, pond reef, and Eurasian milfoil. It does continue to be a top priority for us, Madam Chair, in trying to work with making sure people know they are transporting and trying to provide prevention opportunities wherever possible. It's some of our keys there. And the next box talks about that, providing the number of professional staff and watercraft inspectors to educate the people there. And we have been meeting our goals, providing an additional 4 invasive species specialists to work at the local level on prevention and management. And we now have 6 full-time staff. We've hired 4.5 water resource officers who divide their time between invasive species and wetlands. The WEOs, we call them, wetland enforcement officers, are now doing invasive species work as well, so that's been a huge success.
Okay,
and for those of you who were able to see our labs, our fish contaminant work and invasive species pathology lab, that's about 2% of the expenditures under this activity.
Before you go on, you have a goal for Eurasian buttermilk soil. What's your goal for curly leaf pond weed?
Madam Chair, there really is no goal for curly leaf pond weed, and the reason for that is that we've had curly leaf pond weed in the state now for some 100 years, and it did most of its spreading decades ago before we were really sensitized to the issue of invasive aquatic plants and their spread. So the damage has kind of been done there. It's probably still spreading to some new lakes every year, but it's extremely difficult to keep track of because we know we have it in, I think, something like 750 lakes. My guess is we actually have it in more than that, but that's where we've actually documented it. So that one's been with us a long time.
Any other questions? Strategic objective number 4 focuses on integrated conservation information. This is managing our information systems, interpreting ecological data, developing management tools, and delivering educational products to target audiences. To help inform land use planning, resource-directed decisions, and influence long-term conservation of Minnesota's natural resources. Approximately $10 million is budgeted for these activities, 43% from the special revenue fund, and I believe that would represent some of the dollars that project proposers are paying into for those projects. 20% or $2 million from the Game and Fish Fund, $500,000 from the Environmental Trust Fund, $1.7 from the General Fund, $600,000 from the Natural Resources Fund, and $1 million from the Federal Fund. Large portion of this is environmental review and wetlands programs, also our information systems, education, information delivery, and planning and coordination. If you go to the spreadsheet on page 16 under number 4, building box number 4, it shows that 87% of these projected expenditures for the current biennium will be spent on environmental review and wetlands. To go to the targets there, we don't have a target for environmental review. The long-term desired result is to minimize loss and degradation of habitats. Under wetlands, it's to implement a comprehensive monitoring program to monitor no net loss statewide beginning in 2006 and work with Bollinger and other stakeholders on those activities. And we have been meeting those goals on wetlands. You can see some of the highlights under the environmental review. It's completed the Minnesota Steel environmental impact statement and working on 3 other additional mining EISs. Our staff has reviewed over 1,000 documents for 645 development projects and watershed management plans. We're going to be providing more context on all those activities to the committee, Madam Chair, so I'm not going to go into those in detail. Information systems and education delivery and planning and coordination make up small pieces of those, but they are critical in providing those needed resources and those education opportunities. You can see under Wildlife Education Workshops, Project Wild, we've reached over 400 participants in 28 educator workshops and 20 participants in 1 facilitator workshop. These are the people who will take what we teach them and bring those programs into the classroom and provide additional educational opportunities. These are our mentors, much like the volunteers that we talked about for safety training programs. Lastly, planning coordination, collaborating with National Fish, Wildlife, and Ecological Resource Organizations. The goal was to participate in 3 to 5 guidance documents for the State Wildlife Action Plan. A lot of our activities dealing with the statewide long-term comprehensive plan that LCCMR participated in. Some of those activities came out of these objectives under this objective. We did play a strong, active role in the development of that, and it's a good tool for us to use as an opportunity to figure out where we're going and how we're going to get there.
Representative Ansel.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't like prolonging this, but does the department have any roles to play or functions to perform with regard to this area of ecological services within the boundaries of the Superior and the Chippewa National Forest?
Madam Chair and Representative Ansel, we do get involved with working with the Forest Service on forest management issues in a way where we might help comment on their planning process. Both the department as a whole, not just ecological resources, but our divisions of forestry, fish and wildlife, and ecological resources, we do try to work closely with county governments and the federal government in terms of trying to coordinate on forest management.
Follow up, Madam Chair. I'm specifically interested in functions that we perform within the national forest that the feds either can't or won't, and are we compensated in any way for activities directed to the department from the Forest Service?
Madam Chair and Representative Ansel, I can't think of any options.
Madam Chair, we're looking at some of those areas that you may be thinking of are under forestry, not under ecological resources, perhaps.
Yep.
So we do actively work with the Forest Service and those forest managers on their plans, and hopefully that their goals and our goals mesh sometimes, and we have to help them with that. But we can provide some more context on that, Madam Chair. If there's no other questions, we can move on to operation support. But just quickly, a couple of priority outcomes and measures we talk about. You've seen this slide before, talking about prairie status and protection goals, which we aren't meeting right now. Our FY08 result was 582 acres enrolled in 7 prairie bank easements. Our 10-year goal is 15,000 to 20,000 acres enrolled in those programs, with a long-range target of 75,000 acres in conservation protection. And I believe that one of the main reasons why was because of lack of funding for those activities.
We've provided a substantial amount of bonding money for you guys in this area.
And those dollars, that's not reflected in this goal here, Madam Chair, because those dollars came in late and have in June. We're working on achieving those goals with those dollars.
Okay. I'm hoping with those dollars you will be not getting easements but getting acquisitions, because then we have that opportunity to use that seed to continue to expand, because we have so little prairie left.
Madam Chair, that is a great goal, and that's when we talked about this the other night, about where we are looking to do these acquisitions in the prairie region, and that's exactly what we're looking for, high-quality native prairie ecotype examples that we can acquire. But you can't buy them all the time. Sometimes an easement is the best you can do. So
I understand that, but when you have it in fee, then we have an opportunity that we don't have if you don't have it in fee.
And this is another
buying an opportunity that we really need. So,
thank you, Madam Chair. All right, we're going to go to operations support, and hopefully this will be rather quick. I'll bring down Denise Anderson, who's our OMBS division chief, for any specific questions. But you can see now we're on to page 18 of the spreadsheet, draft D3 spreadsheet. The strategic objective for operations support are threefold: central operations support, regional operations support, and a lot of our grant-making activities, our local initiative grants and other grant activities come out of this division or this function as well. You can see the budget here is $35.2 million for the 08-09 budget, with 33% of that for central operations support, 27% for regional operations support and 40% for recreation and local grants. Under the first objective, Madam Chair, it provided leadership to the department by integrating department operations and formulating and establishing department policies and procedures. This is $11.6 million with a variety of funding sources coming into play, 13% general fund, 5% natural resources fund, 26% federal funding, $500,000 or 4% from the special revenue fund, 8% game and fish fund, 26% from the environmental trust fund, those are basically grants, and 18% from the gift account. Supporting programs include communication with the executive and legislative branches, direct budget and accounting policy for effective use of approximately $300 million per year, our grant administration activities, the boat and federal boat and water safety dollars program are administered through here, and also our information and education, our volunteer magazine is also housed in this part of the department. Let me just go back to the spreadsheet. You can see the goals here. One of the things that we're going to be talking a lot about is under our operations support is how can we reduce these costs. The measure that we have here is to reduce DNR transportation petroleum consumption by 25% since 2011, by 50% in 2015, and reduce our energies in our buildings by 15% by 2011 and 25% by 2025. We've done a lot of these things. Our fleet, we've been recognized nationwide for our fleet management. We've saved millions of dollars by actually buying fleet rather than financing fleet. So we try to actively manage our fleet and pay cash wherever possible, and actually we do pay cash, amortize our vehicles on a 5-year cycle. And you can see here we've eliminated $500,000 in annual debt payment because of that. Also, our facilities that we've talked about, the DNR is the largest charter member of the climate registry, and we're actively working in helping define and apply measurement standards to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in all of our facilities. Energy consumption, fuel efficiency, how we get to where we're going, how we communicate. We do a lot of telecommuting. We're actively exploring the technology. Skype, if you've ever done that, it's desktop video conferencing. We need to reduce our transmission, our emissions, and how we're getting around as much as possible. Well, we do have a lot of places we have to be at. These are going to fall under central operations support. Moving on to the strategic objective number 2, our regional operations support. As we talked about in the beginning of this presentation, I think it was about 2 weeks ago, our regions, we have 4 different regions that are out there throughout the state, and these regions deliver critical services to the public that support interdisciplinary problem solving, public education, and cooperative partnerships. Again, a variety of funding sources, 31% from the general fund, $300,000 from the Natural Resources Fund, 21% from the Federal Fund, Game and Fish Fund is $1.3 million or 14%, and Environmental Trust Fund projects of $2.8 million or 30%. Supporting programs are the coordination of natural resource management programs, providing technical assistance to local communities, stakeholders, and elected officials. These are where all of our county board integrations take place. Our regional directors attend local county board meetings, work with the county board officials, elected officials at all levels of government to help deal with the department project issues. Our strategic land asset management programs are functioning in our regional offices. Also, local administration of financial assistance programs and coordination of the department's emergency response assistance. You can see talking about under regional operations support here, the goal is the number of habitat acres protected and restored in the greater Twin Cities metropolitan area. This is a goal we put on here from our central regional office where they're coordinating the Environmental Trust Fund dollars, those Metro Greenway programs. And there are still 250,000 acres of undeveloped natural land with high ecological significance within the metropolitan area, and that we need to try to figure out how to protect in some way, either through a regional park, wildlife refuge, natural area, or other public designation.
Let's stop right here. This is an excellent figure for all of us to see, because as one of the things we look at, making sure that all Minnesotans have access to habitat, wildlife habitat, and we have the new money, there is opportunity here, that probably more opportunity than I expected. And I think this is a number for those of you who live in the metro area. As we look at what the Heritage Council is doing, I hope they have this number in front of them.
Madam Chair, we will do our best to make sure that that is there. We'll also provide you, you can see the second part of this, is that we have developed green infrastructure maps that allow us to identify these high-quality acres and other important natural resources. And really, it's about communication. This is what we call community assistance, working with communities and people in the metropolitan area to help them understand the value of these open spaces and trying to figure out different opportunities that may exist to get them protected.
Well, I think the folks in the metropolitan area will understand it. I'm just hoping the Heritage Council understands it as well. So,
Representative Hansen will help us with that.
Representative Hansen, are these good numbers for you?
Very helpful.
Okay.
Madam Chair, I'll move on if there's no other questions. Strategic objective number three, and this is our grant-making functions throughout the division. Recreation and local grants provide financial assistance to local governments and private organizations for acquisition and development of outdoor recreation areas and protection and enhancement. $14.2 million here, with the bulk of those coming from the Environmental Trust Fund. We act as the fiscal agent for most of the LCCMR projects, or a lot of the LCCMR projects dealing with conservation. So we do that pass-through opportunities, and I believe we do them at a fairly efficient indirect cost. I don't have that number with me, but I know we've talked about it before, and I think we are doing it the best we can. Talking about the local parks grants, the natural and scenic area grants, conservation partner grants, environmental partnerships grants, regional park grants, remediation fund grants, and last year the legislature was so supportive of our grant-making opportunities and our work in this area, they also asked us to do the public pool upgrade grants that came through as part of the Abby, I can't remember her last name, unfortunately. Yeah, the pool safety program. Madam Chair, this would be also the area that in the governor's budget we'll talk about in FY10 and 11, where the governor's budget does recommend a portion of the park heritage dollars go to regional grants, Greater Minnesota grants, and it would be our hope that we could utilize this existing infrastructure to deliver that service.
And that's Representative Portman.
Just a question then. So the public pool grant program, do people apply to you to if they need the funding to help upgrade?
Madam Chair, yes, it was a limited amount of money. It was $50,000 that was actually appropriated to the project and had some specific time frames on it. We received 10 grant requests. The maximum amount was up to 75% of the total cost. We could provide more detail if you're interested in this, but the city of Fairfax, Gaylord, Sartell, Minneapolis, Loring Park, Pearl Park, Fuller Park, city of Tyler, city of Wells, city of Winnebago, and the city of Medford all received funding for those pool upgrades. Some of them, St. Paul, I know, closed their pool or Como Park, for example. Some people did not upgrade them, but they're made. I don't know what the need is, but we were, again, just acting as a fiscal agent with some grant parameters on that, but we can try to find some more information, or I can get more information if you desire.
Thank you. The reason I ask is I've been trying to figure out who in state government has a comprehensive list of public pools, and I haven't found any entity yet that has a complete list of the pools in the state. And
Madam
so
Chair, I believe the Department of Health should have something like that. I don't
you
know.
Could help me. I'm not on the health committee, but if you have any
you call
names or suggestions of who I follow up with.
I call it John Linkstein at Department of Health. I'll get you the number.
Okay, thank you.
He used to work for the DNR. That's why I know him. To talk to. Madam Chair, if there are no other questions, that would complete. I just, a couple of things. This talks about the Metro Conservation Corridor that we just spoke about, those community partnerships protected, and we can give you this map in greater detail. Actually, I think I'll give it to Representative Hansen. This is an example of the Metro Conservation Corridor. It's a partnership carried out by our regional operations. And just this is where the coordination of the interdisciplinary actions needed to ensure that we're meeting the conservation targets is done in ways that optimize our overall mission and results. Summary of our results here, again, the red box is just because of lack of funding. Didn't have enough grant dollars to meet those goals that we established. And this, we all talk about managing for results. This goes back to Governor Pawlenty in 2003. And it basically is why we are successful. I think we're so successful at trying to pull this information together for y'all. In 2003, we began down this road of developing challenging indicators and benchmarks for all levels of government, measuring results and using those outcomes to guide our decisions and direct our work. It is something that we do take seriously. We've been doing it for a long time. The conservation agenda, the fact dates and issues of those do provide that context. And I do want to thank you for this opportunity, because I do think it is an opportunity to provide education for everyone, the committee and citizens who've been watching this. I know a lot of people have been, because they get calls from people saying, I saw you on TV, what are you doing down there? But it has been a great learning opportunity for us, and I think it'll provide great benefits as we talk about 2010 and 11 budgets. And I don't know if it'll expedite that process at all, but it'll at least give us a good background to start from.
Well, on behalf of the committee, thank you for the work. I think you all have done a good job.
Thank you very much.
We have certainly been a good education for me, and it's certainly better than the information we had in the last budget go round when we were making decisions. So I think hopefully our decisions will be better. But I think the most important thing is for Minnesotans to be able to see what they're purchasing with their tax dollars, because I think they'll like a lot of what they're seeing, and they will want to say, let's have some more of that. So I think this is critically important, and so good job up there, because I know that this has been a lot of work to do to pull it together. Anybody else have any questions? I bet people want to go home. With another thank you, meeting's adjourned.
Thank you very much.